Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
You're a prisoner of war. Act like one. Name, rank, serial number, hands in there. You've been captured. Don't act like you haven't been. They've already got a make on you. Already got your fingerprints. You've already been computerized for life. Don't play like you have some kind of secret army, because you don't. You're alone. Three sets of blinking lights. Get out and do what you're told. And no lip. None. Prisoner of war. Show some intelligence. But even as I speak now, there's somebody out there who isn't. Driving down the highway 40 miles an hour, grabbing up in people's yards and all like that. You're going to be dead in the next 5 minutes. And then the report's going to say, it looks like he was going for a gun. You already know that. I act like you don't. Everybody out there who's doing that kind of stuff, who's within the sound of my voice, that's who I'm talking to. You know the routine. Don't play like you don't. We play too much. Play, play, play. Everything is a movie scene.
Very serious about nothing. About not being very serious.
You haven't done anything? What are you running for? If you have done something, what are you running for? How far you think you can run? To the moon?
Police say they're looking into what happened, but deny any kind of racial profiling.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, July 20th, 2016. So I have been told we are having some difficulties with the server for some reason today. The Black Talk Radio Network founder, Mr. Scotty Reed, is working to try to get the problem resolved ASAP. In the meantime, you can listen live via the phone line. If you want to, folks that are listening in, if you want to share via Twitter, Facebook, any of your social media outlets, Instagram, whatever you use, if you want to post and just make sure that you include when you post for folks to listen to this broadcast live, to call in right now. And then as soon as the server is corrected, I will let folks know so you can just listen your normal outlets. If you listen at Black Talk Radio Network or TuneIn or wherever else you get the live feed at, I'll let folks know once that is corrected. But you can call in the number 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Right on. That's it. We're supposed to do this program on Monday, had to reschedule. I hope we didn't throw folks off too much, but very much looking forward to today's broadcast. There's been so much attention, it seems like, for the last 2 years, intense attention on the issue of racism and policing. Lots of black people being shot, killed, strangled by enforcement officials, and then within the last 2 weeks, the shooting of police officers in Dallas, Texas, where three officers were reportedly shot and killed. And then in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, literally just as we were about to go live on the air this past Sunday, the killing, in Dallas, it was five police officers. And then this Sunday, three police officers in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, were shot and killed. This was just literally days after the shooting of Alton Sterling, black male in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, has provoked lots of intense conversation all the way up to the presidential stage with the election coming up and what have you. Thought it would be great to get one of our guests, favorite guests, back on the program. This is his fourth time visiting with us. We've had him on the program previously. We discussed his first book, Breaking Rank, A Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing. His most recent book, it just came out this year, To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. Folks always enjoy hearing from him. He has about three decades of policing experience, including the former chief of the Seattle Police Department. Joining us live, Mr. Norm Stamper. Mr. Stamper, you with us?
I am, Gus. Good to be with you.
For sure. Good to have you back with us, sir. As I said, you've been, this is your fourth time on the program. I think a lot of folks have heard some of your previous visits, and it seems you have been everywhere the last week or so promoting the book and talking about a lot of the events. He was just recently on News One and Democracy Now, NPR. Just anything that you think would be important for folks to know before we get started?
No, I can't think of anything. It's obviously a very big, big topic.
For sure. Anything about you specifically, just to make sure I'm being clear, anything they should know about you specifically before we get started?
Well, I'm a proud grandfather. I have a couple of 12-year-old granddaughters who are the apple of my eye. They live in San Diego, and every chance I get to go down there and visit, every chance that they get to come up here and visit, just makes my day.
Right on. And for folks who have not seen you, you are a white man, is that correct?
I am a white man. I'm a 72-year-old white male.
Right on. Retired enforcement official, we will get started. I'm going to actually start with your book and then kind of weave into the more recent shootings and get some of your thoughts on that, because I think a lot of it ties in directly with a lot of what you have in the brand new book, To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. You write in the preface, this is page 19, you write, I believe officers Ramos and Liu of the NYPD, and these were the two officers who were shot and killed in December of 2014 after the non-indictment of Daniel Pantaleo for the choking death of Eric Garner. They were shot and killed by Ismael Brinsley, a black male. This was December 2014. So I believe officers Ramos and Liu of the NYPD, Harris County Sheriff's Deputy Darren Goforth, and other ambushed officers would be alive today, but for the inflammatory, the only good cop is a dead cop thread of some fringe protest messages. I would like to believe, hell, I do believe, that only a small fraction of police critics want to see officers shot in the head as they pump gas or sit in their patrol cars. This is not a plea to end demonstrations against police violence and other abuses. Far from it. In fact, a strong, sustained citizens' movement against police brutality and racism is the cornerstone of any viable reform effort. Moreover, by design, protest demonstrations are intended to disrupt and bedevil the status quo, and that has never been more pertinent or more urgent than it is today. But I do make an appeal here and now for critics to embrace nonviolence in word and deed. Again, from the preface of the new book, the question I wanted to ask is exactly how did you conclude that officers Ramos and Liu, as well as Mr. Goforth, that their deaths were in some way connected to the fringe protest messages of violence against police. How did you make that conclusion?
Well, yeah, it would be very easy to say, well, it's just deductive reasoning. But in fact, there is some evidence. Certainly in the New York case, we had Mr. Brimsley essentially announcing in advance why he was coming from his home to New York City, and he did in fact carry out his threat to kill police officers. And as you've accurately quoted my book, this was in the immediate aftermath of the decision not to prosecute Pantaleo, the detective in the Eric Garner choking death. So it's not hard, I think, for anyone to see that tensions in this country between police and community, and particularly communities of color, have escalated to the point at which those who are either predisposed toward violence or who have been who have had circumstances tilt them in the direction of violence are in fact acting on that impulse. I think we saw that in Dallas. We saw it in Baton Rouge as well.
Who would you say is most to blame for these incidents, this violence against police officers in the case in New York 2014 or Dallas, Baton Rouge, Louisiana this week? Who would you say is most to blame, the fringe protesters or officers who have committed violence, unjust violence, against black citizens like Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, and the people, white people, that have allowed this violence against black citizens to go unchecked and or even encouraged it for decades, centuries now?
It is definitely the latter. It is definitely, I think, within the capacity of the institution, as well as, inviting citizen participation, full community partnership with the police, to end the patterned violence against young African-American men, which I do believe is predicated on raw racism, as well as structural and institutional racism. I think it's just, as you have pointed out, we're not talking about decades, we're talking about centuries. We're talking about generations of African-American men who have died at the hands of police unnecessarily, unjustifiably. Now, my former fellow officers don't like to hear that talk coming from a cop, either in service or retired. But it is the truth from where I sit, and many others see it the same way.
Before I get my next question, I kind of got to put this in context a little bit so that listeners can understand things a little bit better. Making sure I'm talking to the same Norm Stamper. You don't need to give the full anecdote because you've done it a couple times before when you visited with us. But it's in Breaking Rank where you talk about your early days as an enforcement official down in California when you were being trained as a rookie cop. Your white officer supervisor who was training you, he said, "Hey, get your nigger knocker. Go in there, get the biggest black guy that you can find, bring him out. We're going to beat him down and take him in." That's true, correct?
That's true.
Okay. And you also, in Breaking Rank, you wrote that you used to participate in some of this brutality in your time as an enforcement official, that some of the anecdotes that you wrote about, you would choke a suspect out and whisper in their ear, "You're going to die, asshole." Is that true?
That's true.
Okay. And that it used to be kind of a celebrated thing, enforcement officers being violent. If you all went out and shot someone, that you would go back to the station, "I shot someone," it would almost be like celebrating at a football game or some sort of sporting contest, a high five, that sort of thing. Is that accurate?
Well, let me put that one in context. When I became a cop, and I realized, Gus, and so do your listeners, that this is ancient history. I became a beat cop in San Diego in 1966. And in those days, as much as we are just awash in a sea of violence these days, police officers were not being shot at. Police officers were not shooting anyone. And in fact, it had been 37 years since a San Diego police officer had been slain in the line of duty. It was kind of understood as a rookie as or as a recruit in the academy, if you're going to get killed on the job, it's because you fell asleep at 3 o'clock in the morning and drove off the road. And I think it's real important for everyone to understand that times have changed. I attribute much of this to the drug war and certainly more recently to 9/11. But throughout the history, the culture of policing has celebrated violence, has rewarded police officers for, quote, getting the job done. In 1972, I shot and killed a man, a white man, who was threatening to kill his three-year-old son. Now, when I got back to the station, those high fives and so forth were not in evidence. There could be a couple of reasons for that. One was that I was a lieutenant by then. I'd been promoted twice in my early career at that point. And maybe people felt that it was kind of unseemly to try to high-five a lieutenant for having shot and killed someone. At the same time, there was this attitude, and I saw it all around me. It was maybe he is this Norm Stamper, a real cop. Maybe he's not a social worker, a bleeding heart liberal, a hippie cop, that sort of thing. I got lots and lots of names in those days, but I did get a very strong undercurrent, as well as occasionally explicit statements to the effect that I had done the job. Maybe I was a real cop. So that sentiment's certainly still there.
Appreciate the added layers of context so that people get an understanding. And just to round it out before I get to the question that all this is connected to, you in your book, you talk extensively. I even learned a few things, and I had read and researched about John Burge in Chicago, where you want to talk about years, decades of systematic police terrorism, racist terrorism against black citizens in Chicago, Illinois, that was allowed to go unchecked by state attorney Daley. At the time, he eventually became mayor of Chicago and did the same thing, just allowed this to continue, and then kind of scoffed at the notion years later of, you know, that he did anything wrong about this. And I mean, this is really bad torture and abuse, terrorism against black people. They've since paid reparations for this. You talk about that in your book. And just checking the Seattle Times today, there was an article in the Seattle Times. The title is, "With Just 79 Police Officers, Tequila Pays Out $1.5 million to Settle Civil Rights Lawsuits." Federal court records show the city of Tequila has paid out more than $1.5 million to settle civil rights lawsuits against police officers since 2014, mostly involving allegations of excessive force. So I add all of that so that people can understand my question. Now, the question that I wanted to get to is, when you say in the book that I make an appeal here and now for critics to embrace nonviolence in word and deed, coming from a white man, in my view, in a system of white supremacy with the decades, centuries of terroristic violence that enforcement officers, whites in general, but since we're talking about the police, have meted out to black citizens, I find that to be a massive act of racism for whites to say that there has to be some sort of nonviolent protest to all of this. If black people or any victims of white supremacy decide that violence is not going to be unilateral, and it just being whites that are inflicting violence in order to get this problem solved, if the victims of racism decide that they are going to be violent in order to come to a solution to solve this problem, I find it a massive act of racism for white people to say that you have to be nonviolent to solve this conflict. The black people should get the nigger knocker, so to speak, and decide that, hey, I'm going to do something since you all continue to do this. I'm going to get the nigger knocker and see if I can do something to move towards solving this problem. Your response?
I come from the perspective, a pretty simple one, that two wrongs do not make a right. I come from the perspective that there are ways and means for grassroots protesters, for those who would completely and radically reform law enforcement, to do that without shooting cops in the head as they sit in their police cars. I can't think of too many other kinds of acts that would set back the cause of meaningful reform. I totally get the impulse. I certainly understand how grievously wounded so many in the African American, and to a lesser degree, but certainly to a significant degree, the Latino community, depending on your particular jurisdiction. But in Chicago, for example, with Burge carrying out his reign of terror, and you've aptly described that, he was torturing African American men. He was engaged in the most severe forms of abuse imaginable, and he did in fact continue to do that with impunity for many, many years. I totally understand why the people of Chicago, particularly African Americans in Chicago, would be beyond upset. I get that. But when it comes to the future, when it comes to not just reparations and making amends and atoning for past abuses, but for carving out a new future, one in which the police become the people's police, I think it's utterly counterproductive to engage in ambush shootings of police officers. Recall, please, that in Baton Rouge, a young black officer was shot and killed over the weekend. So it really I think becomes an important topic of conversation in the dialogue about how we redress grievances. I think if you subscribe to the theory as Martin Luther King did, as Gandhi did, as Nelson Mandela did, that violence begets violence, then I think we need to reject violence as a means of protest.
I will, if we want to name drop the nonviolence, I will point out Nelson Mandela did not always subscribe to nonviolence. He was a member of Mkhonto Sizwe, which was the violent arm of counter white supremacy against apartheid in South Africa. He came to that stance after he had been imprisoned for about 3 decades and tortured in South Africa. And Ta-Nehisi Coates, not someone who I think most people regard as being a radical or some crazy person, he has articulated the exact same stance in long essay format, that this basically is an act of racism when white people, like Mr. Stamper, submit that we have to be nonviolent in approaching solving the problem of racism, particularly after whites have meted out centuries of violence and terrorism, to then turn around and say that you have to be nonviolent in solving this problem. Have you seen any evidence in terms of white people, when you talk about moving forward to a meaningful future where we solve this problem, have you seen any evidence where white people look like they are moving towards a realistic, sincere solution to this problem? Just talking about the police realm, where we do not have any more racist, systemic, white supremacist policing of black people in this area of the world. Have you seen any evidence of that?
Oh, sure. I've definitely seen it in both San Diego and Seattle. I've seen white protesters. I've seen the occasional white police officer who will agree completely with your diagnosis of the problem, and black and white disagreeing with the prescription for the problem, if that prescription includes ambushing police officers. I can tell you that what happens in a white institution like policing, I'll tell you from my point of view exactly what happens when police officers are ambushed. They become hypervigilant, they become more frightened, and behind all fear, I think, or behind all anger that they feel toward those who've done the shooting, is fear. And a scared cop is a dangerous cop. We need to find ways to talk to one another. We need to acknowledge the very real problem of white superiority, the feeling of dominance on the part of so many white officers. I draw the line at violence. I just think it's not productive. I think it is counterproductive. I certainly respect those, like Malcolm X, particularly earlier in his career, Nelson Mandela, who later in his political career not only rejected violence but actively sought reconciliation.
That was the next question that I was going to ask in terms of how I do want to point out before I get to the next question, though, I do not see any evidence that white people, I mean, we've been talking about this problem of police brutality for a long, long time. This goes back to before Mr. Stamper ever had a badge in San Diego, California.
It goes
California.
Back to the slave patrols, for sure.
Exactly. And that right there, to me, shows that whites are not really serious about solving this problem. The question I did want to ask, though, in terms of the impact that these shootings have on white officers in particular, you already touched on it. I just want to point out for listeners, I thought one of the most important themes in your first book, I didn't see it in the second book, but I did, Breaking Rank, we talked about it before, that you said you've concluded that white people are afraid of black people, black males particularly, and the darker they are, the bigger they are, the more fearful whites are. And you see that play out in policing, and in your view, that is a major contributing factor in a lot of these incidents. Sandra Bland, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, that is a major contributing factor in a lot of these incidents. How do you think that is going to change, be elevated after what has happened in Baton Rouge, Dallas, Texas? And have you talked to any officers since these incidents have happened?
Well, I have actually talked with a couple of officers after the incidents. I've got an informal social gathering next week or 2 weeks from now with some of my former colleagues, and I know what the theme is going to be for that conversation. It becomes, with kind of depressing regularity, it becomes a theme of many of these. It's an annual gathering of old friends. And I know one of the things that I'm going to hear is, my God, have we not learned a thing since the 60s or even before? That when white police officers behave the way Michael Slager behaved in North Charleston, South Carolina, Jason Van Dyke in the killing of Laquan McDonald in Chicago, the list goes on and on. That officer, for example, a Texas state trooper who stopped Sandra Bland, was completely out of control, screaming at the top of his lungs, and he's talking about a black woman. I suspect that had Bland been a black male driving that car, he would have kicked it up a couple of decibels and been even more screechy and out of control in dealing with that individual. This is Norm Stamper offering personal insights, personal observations. I'm not offering empirical evidence, but I've seen it throughout my career. The more scared a cop is, the more likely it is that he or she is going to act impulsively and violently. The more scared a cop, the less likely it is that he will even be able to see straight. Because one of the things that we know about fear is that perception is affected. I think of the Diallo shooting, Amadou Diallo in New York City. It was horrific. He was a young immigrant who had been told by his friends, he did not speak English, who had been told by his friends, if the police ever stop you, for God's sakes, pull out your ID. Well, of course, the moment he reached for his wallet, trying to abide by what his friend had said were the expectations of the police in those circumstances. This was in a vestibule of an apartment building, as I recall it. The moment he pulled out that wallet, one of the cops, there were four of them, yelled gun, and that's all it took. And all of them start firing, 41 shots in all, only 19 of which, by the way, hit Diallo. And you can be sure each one was aimed at Diallo. So one of the things that we know is that perception is affected by fear. How does a wallet morph into a handgun? If all you see is a little slice of black in somebody's hand, you conclude that that's a .40 caliber Glock, and the guns come out and the bullets ring out. I mean, it's traceable, I'm convinced, to a combination of racism and fear.
Mm. You, in the book, I thought this was an important passage, just to make sure that folks don't think this is a total just afraid of black people. I think the desire to practice white supremacy racism is also a major contributing factor in these incidents. This is from the new book, Protect and Serve, on page 76. You write about the fear, and then you also include the racism aspect. And you say, what if they beat Rodney King for the pure bigoted joy of it? With at least one of the officers, Lawrence Powell, such a case could be argued. Powell made statements both before and after the beating that would come back to haunt him, hurt the defense of the officers, and taint the LAPD for many years to come. Just before responding to the CHP, California Highway Patrol, chase, Powell had cleared from a domestic violence call involving African Americans. He typed on the mobile data terminal in his car that the scene was right out of Gorillas in the Mist. He was equally forthcoming when, after the King debacle, during which he delivered most of the 56 baton blows, he wrote on the car's computer for all his fellow officers to see, "I haven't beaten anyone this bad in a long time." It doesn't sound like Powell was frightened, more like he took great delight in expounding racist views and crushing skulls. I will stop there. I wanted to get your response. There might be a significant number of white enforcement officers who, in light of these recent shootings where you have alleged black shooters in both cases, who were allegedly saying that they were doing this to get revenge on white officers. Do you think that there also could be white officers who say, hey, I'm upset about this and I'm going to go out to kind of set the record straight, to kind of get things in order, show these black people who's the boss, who's in charge, and I'm going to go out and whatever I have to do, if that means I put the cuffs on extra tight, if that means I rough up some black people, do some extra stop and frisks, just to let them know who's in charge, who's the boss?
Absolutely. I think there's that possibility. I mean, the fact that it has happened historically doesn't give me any comfort that it's not going to happen again, especially in light of everything that you just described. Let's think about Powell in the Rodney King beating for a moment. I meant what I said when I wrote. It sure didn't seem like he was afraid. Well, if he wasn't afraid, why wasn't he? Maybe it was the fact that there were, I don't know, in the neighborhood of 20 officers at the scene at the end of a big chase. That's not uncommon. So you got 20 officers backing him up, covering him, and then he just wails with impunity. He was committing a criminal offense. His fellow officers could have, should have, never, ever would have jumped in, hooked him up, and put him in the backseat of a police car. I'm talking now about their fellow officer. Had they done that at the beginning of this incident, when it first became obvious that it was going to go completely south, they could have avoided one of the most catalytic, memorable events in the history of the institution. But of course, historically, if that had happened, we wouldn't have known about the kinds of abuses that we see on the part of some police officers against many African Americans.
Hmm. Are you surprised that there haven't been more of these type of incidents in terms of retaliations against police officers? I know we talked before when you were on the program with us in 2014, Maurice Clemens, that was here in Seattle, black male who shot and killed several officers back in 2009. Are you surprised that there haven't been more, given the gravity and long-running pattern of police terrorism against black citizens here in the U.S.?
I am surprised, and the people I hang with, who I would describe as progressive or at least reform-minded retired police chiefs, and many still within the ranks as chief executives, would tell you, and they don't need a special moment of honesty to say this, they would tell you they are also surprised that we haven't seen more of it. There is only so much a people can take before we begin to see the kinds of things that we've seen over the last few weeks. Let me add one thing to that, Gus. When I was a cop in 1966, even though we had anti-war demonstrations, rocks and bottles, occasionally a sniper, a report of sniper fire, Molotov cocktails, and so forth, we had civil rights insurrections, we had campus unrest, we had a lot of social turmoil, and this is a huge but, in the months and years ahead, after Watts, after Newark, after Harlem, after Detroit, after, on a more modest scale, San Diego, Seattle, we saw the police, in what I consider to be kind of a fumbling, stumbling way, try to make amends by creating community relations programs and so forth. Unfortunately, I think the motive was not a deep motive. In other words, the kind of motive that you want to see. It's like, we need to put an end once and for all to racism, institutional, individual, structural racism. We need to end it. We need to end this notion of white supremacy, white superiority. There were people of goodwill, good intentions of all colors who were saying, let's come together and improve the relationship. But if you don't alter the structure, if you don't alter that paramilitary, bureaucratic, racist structure of the institution itself, then, you know, I guess I have to say we'll be back here again and again and again over the years.
Context of white supremacy. Seems like I just heard someone say that I hadn't really seen evidence of white people being sincere in their efforts to solve this problem. What do you make of what is being called the Ferguson effect, where even FBI Director James Comey has said that in many places across the country they are reporting rising crime rates, and that is being attributed at least in part to many officers saying that they do not want to be the next viral video of an enforcement official arresting someone and it going bad and it having to be or being labeled excessive or unnecessary force. So they're just not policing as vigorously, and that is producing these higher rates of crime. And they're terming this the Ferguson effect. What do you make of that?
Well, I've heard the Ferguson effect mentioned in several different contexts. But the one in which you're mentioning is probably the most common. And the FBI director did, in fact, say that he thought that was happening. Rahm Emanuel made a reference to police officers being reduced to the fetal position in the face of crime and violence on the streets because of the Ferguson effect. That's understandable because some people are reporting evidence of it. I don't think we've seen any studies yet. It's probably too early for that. It would be nice to have empirical evidence of the so-called Ferguson effect, but I think it's natural to assume that some officers will do just that. They will start, another term for it is de-policing, and they'll drive by that darkened alley at 3 in the morning, seeing a figure down at the other end of it. Could be a hot prowler, could be a rapist, a stranger on stranger, violence, that sort of thing, and just drive on by because, you know, why bother? Why risk seeing my name in the paper if I get into a tussle or, God forbid, I have to use my firearm in overcoming armed resistance to my actions? Now, I think any police officer of any color, gender, age, who engages in de-policing when so many, particularly in poor communities and communities of color, need protection and service to succumb to the Ferguson effect. Big mistake. Those folks should not be police officers, in my opinion.
In the new book, you have a section where you talk about technology in policing. You talk specifically about drones and a lot of the concerns that people have about their usage and even some suggestions in terms for how they can be employed to help police do their job and also mitigating concerns that citizens have about their usage. One of the concerns that you write about in terms of the use of drones in conjunction with weapons, you write domestic drones should not be equipped with lethal or non-lethal weapons. And my mind immediately went to the situation in Dallas, the suspected shooter, Micah Xavier Johnson, where they deployed a robot with a explosive device, which ultimately killed him. And most of the reports that I've seen, they've said that this seems to be the first time in the history of U.S. policing that this has happened, where they have used some sort of robot drone, if you will, to, in a lethal manner, to take down a civilian, to take down a suspect in this case. What are your thoughts on that? And is this going to be something that we see become regular usage in terms of deploying robots in this manner, in this case, a lethal manner?
Well, I would certainly hope that it does not evolve to the point at which it becomes a regular tactic. I heard the police chief in that city, for whom I have a lot of respect, say, I'm not going to second-guess my officers. He did not make that call, but he's not going to second-guess his officers. I do think he needs to evaluate the tactic. If you have an active shooter, if people in uniform or not are falling on city streets and you have an opportunity to take out that shooter, I think you have an obligation to do so. Now, the question is, can you, you know, there's so many terms, they're euphemisms, can we neutralize the threat? Well, let's go with that language for the moment. Can we neutralize the threat, which really means basically, can we stop him in his tracks? If we can do it without killing him, that's preferred. But if we have to kill him, that is sort of an occupational necessity for police officers on far fewer occasions than most people think. But let's assume for the moment that the shooter is continuing to fire and that the safest way to neutralize that fatal threat, lethal threat, is to take him out with a robot, then I guess I would side with the chief. My concern, of course, is all of those other circumstances. We've seen too many of them just in the last couple of years, but throughout the history of the institution, where no lethal force was justified in the first place. I mean, is there a way that you can stick a robot in a room, have it, you know, inch its way into the room with chemical agents or with a taser or some other non-lethal weapon, neutralize the threat, put the suspect in handcuffs, and go about the business of trying to understand what happened, getting aid for people who need it, taking care of crime scenes, and doing all the other traditional police business. So I would like to see community involved intimately in this conversation. I'm talking about the African American as well as all other communities. Being at the table when these kinds of decisions are being made, I'll say it again, the police in this country belong to the people, not the other way around. So the people need to be intimately involved in the conversations and in not just conversations, not just relationship building, but in setting policy. And while on the topic, I think citizens need to be sitting next to police commanders when the hiring choices are being made. Citizens need to be teaching in the academy. They need to be involved, obviously, in citizen oversight, and particularly in use of force and lethal force reviews, intimately and directly involved. And you can expect, I've made those recommendations, of course, you can expect a lot of opposition from my former colleagues.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I would only encourage black people listening to the program, if the history of policing in this area of the world, with the way that previous technology has been used, whether it's a taser, the nigger knocker, handcuffs and how that has gone in relation to black people, man, that is a harbinger of what might be to come with this increased technology and what have you, the situation in Dallas. Just something to keep in mind. I think that's something that has not been discussed nearly as much, that unprecedented use of robotics in taking down Micah Xavier Johnson. The rhetoric of law and order that has been employed greatly just this week in Cleveland, Ohio, at the Republican National Convention for Donald Trump, and this theme that, you know, hey, America is falling apart. This is a part of making America great again. We've got all these tax on enforcement officials. A lot of people have made the comparison to 1968 with Richard Nixon, that you had a lot of the same issues in terms of black people, the civil rights movement. The Black Panther Party had just been founded 2 years previously, 1966. What kind of similarities do you see, and how do you think all of this is going to impact the presidential election this fall?
Striking similarities, frightening similarities. If you care at all about community police relations, the last thing you want is a presidential candidate labeling himself using the shorthand law and order. We knew what it meant under Nixon. It was definitely targeting blacks. To a degree, certainly anti-war demonstrators, anybody that would threaten his re-election, had a conversation in the Oval Office about targeting African Americans in the soon-to-be-announced drug war. So every time I hear anyone use that term, people say, "Well, what's wrong with it? We are a nation of laws and we need order to survive," and on and on and on. It is shorthand for racism. It is shorthand for brutality. It is shorthand certainly for a presidential candidate who has behaved the way Donald Trump has behaved during the campaign, during the lead up to the nomination and beyond. He wants to hit people. He's applauding his followers for engaging in assault and battery. This is a man who should never be allowed anywhere near the Oval Office. But just returning very quickly to the theme of technology, as I write in my book, I don't know of a time when technology has ever made a U-turn. When it comes to technological progress, whether that represents social or ethical progress or moral progress, entirely different question. But when it comes to the technology, we don't go backwards. We just add to what we have, and if it can produce non-lethal outcomes in conflicts where death has been a result, wonderful. If it can, if one of those cute little planes can find a lost child, wonderful. If it can bring to a successful early conclusion of a dangerous high-speed pursuit, that's terrific. The technology will continue to develop and evolve, but how we use it is the profound question.
Context of white supremacy, Mr. Norm Stamper. Does the name Larry Darnell Gordon, is that familiar?
You know, it is familiar, but you're going to have to refresh my memory.
Okay. I will refresh your memory. Just let me ask, give me one more name. Curtis Ayers, is that name familiar?
That one, not quite so familiar.
Okay. For listeners, Larry Darnell Gordon, this is a white male. Just this month, before the shooting in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, in between the Dallas shooting and the shooting in Baton Rouge, Mr. Larry Darnell Gordon, a white man in Michigan, a convict, he was in a Michigan courtroom. He killed two bailiffs and attempted to escape. He was facing a long jail term. This was big news for like 30 seconds, and then it disappeared totally. And I do not generally hear this, his name mentioned when people talk about this rhetoric of a war on cops and law and order, and there's no respect for police when people get on that shtick. Mayor, I've never heard Mr. Giuliani, Rudy Giuliani, former mayor of New York, I've never heard him mention his name and some of the other folks who talk about this war on police and disrespect of enforcement officials. Curtis Ayers, this is a white male in Kansas. He shot and killed an enforcement official in May of this year before we even got to Dallas and all that, and stole his car, no less. He's in custody now. He's facing the death penalty. But this is also a white man. This is a theme that some of our listeners have pointed out, and myself, that there seems to be disproportionate focus when a black person kills an enforcement official or is accused of killing an enforcement official. It is huge news. Everybody talks about it, and it becomes a part of this. Oh my gosh, society is unfolding. President Obama is to blame. There's a war on cops. When a white person kills an enforcement official, maybe it's news for 30 minutes and it disappears and it does not get included in the rhetoric of there's a war on cops, President Obama is to blame, Black Lives Matter is to blame. It's just this is a tragedy and moving forward. Am I misperceiving this, or do you see a similar pattern?
Well, I'm your Exhibit A, and I offer myself up as proof of what you're saying, because I didn't instantly remember either of those names. Now that you've refreshed my memory, I remember both of them, but I also would agree with you completely that wasn't a 24-hour news cycle, that was a 5-minute news cycle. And I do believe that the discrimination that we see, institutionalized probably in our media, needs to be called directly into focus, and we need to have a conversation about why that is. Why is it that, you know, people will say, well, white cops shoot more white people than they do black people. That's true. That's literally true. But there are far more white people in this country than there are black people. And African Americans are 2.5 times more likely, at a minimum, to be shot by white police officers than are white citizens when we look at proportionality, when we gauge that against population. So, yeah, I think we have a very big problem beyond the police with the media in reporting these kinds of issues.
This is, and both of these incidents happened this year, just to emphasize that, not just this year, like since May, both the incidents that I just,
they're
very
they're
current,
fresh. They're recent.
Very yeah. current events, and this is a long-running trend. If people are, I suspect many of you don't remember, but in Nevada in 2014, a white couple, a white male and a white female, they went out and shot several enforcement officials, killed several enforcement officials. That, too, it got news attention for maybe 30 minutes. It disappeared, and it did not get included in the rhetoric of this war on cops and President Obama's to blame, Black Lives Matter is to blame. You have talked consistently about the war on drugs and going back law and order, Richard Nixon, where he said explicitly he was doing this to go after leftists who opposed the Vietnam War and black people. And I just emphasize, he didn't say blacks and Latinos. He didn't say people of color. He said black people.
He said the Negro.
Hey, make it plain. Make it plain.
He made it very plain. He actually didn't talk about left-wing activists. He talked about hippies and the Negro, which is, as I recall from Ehrlichman and Haldeman's reports of that conversation in the Oval Office, he said, well, what we need is a law and order campaign. What we need is a war on drugs. Now, we will know what that means, us three white guys in the Oval Office. We'll know what that means. But everybody's opposed to drugs, so if we wage war on drugs and black militants, members of the Panther Party or activists in general, get handcuffed and carted off to jail behind nonviolent drug offenses, then we will have accomplished our purpose. And it's despicable, but it's a key part of American history.
Absolutely. And I think most white people, I think they understand what that means as well at this point. I suspect many of them did for a long time. You, in your book, you say that part of what can be done to help correct this problem, legalization of cannabis and making that a key feature of what they call criminal justice reform. What problems would be solved with cannabis legalization?
Well, I go far beyond cannabis, Gus. I support the legalization of all drugs. I have a personal as well as a professional or a political view on this, and that is that I'm over 21 years of age. Whatever I choose to put into my body is my business. It is not my business, however, if having injected, ingested, or inhaled some substance, I go out and kill someone on a highway, or I furnish to a child, or I do any other kind of criminal act, then I need to pay a stiff price for that. But beyond my personal view, we need to make note of the fact that we have spent $1.3 trillion prosecuting the drug war. We have incarcerated tens of millions of nonviolent drug offenders, wildly disproportionate numbers of whom are black. We have, in the process of waging war, and you don't fight a war without an enemy. You don't fight a war, for that matter, without propaganda. So what did we do when Nixon famously declared war on drugs? We put police officers as frontline soldiers in that war. And then we wonder why things don't seem to be getting a whole lot better. So if we're in fact arresting, charging, prosecuting, and sentencing, in some cases to very long prison terms, African Americans, when whites who commit the same acts, the same drug offenses, are largely going unpoliced, then we've got a deep-seated racial, structural racial problem and a problem that would go a long way toward being solved if we were to end the drug war. If we were to replace prohibition, which we thought we had learned from the 1930s, the 1933, is just a failed public policy. It's a bankrupt policy that has never worked and never will. So if we can end that drug war, replace prohibition with a regulatory system that we would rigorously enforce, and frankly, free from prisons those individuals who have been racially discriminated against in the form of powdered versus crack cocaine, for example, free all of those for nonviolent drug offenses, reserve our prison space for those who are genuinely, certifiably dangerous, and end this war against our own people. I get wound up on this, Gus, because I think, my God, how come people can't see the harm that is being done? What is the good of this? Drugs are more readily available, lower prices, higher levels of potency, more accessible to our children now than they've ever been. So it's a colossal failure, and we need to end it.
You and I were both in Washington State, where cannabis has been legal since the 2012 vote. And I do not see substantial evidence that that helps correct the problem of racism, white supremacy. I know the Washington Post, they did a report in May of this year, very recently, where they said they still, it's been almost 4 years, it'll be 4 years in November since the vote to legalize. But they said they still don't really have strong evidence, yay or nay, in terms of cannabis legalization, this having some direct impact on the number of black people that end up being incarcerated in Washington State. And then in Colorado, where they also legalized at the same time that Washington did, in fact, they just had a report, NPR and many other mainstream outlets, that there has been an increase in the number of black juveniles, non-white juveniles in total, in Colorado that have been arrested for some sort of cannabis use, even, and this is just since it's been legalized. And that was a big part of the whole campaign, that this is going to somehow deal with what they call racial disparities and how these drug laws are enforced. I've said this consistently. In my view, since the beginning of our conversation, I don't see the evidence that white people are sincere about ending the practice of racism. I just don't think that ending the quote unquote war on drugs, I just don't think that that's going to have a substantial impact in terms of racism and policing as it relates to black people. Your response?
Yeah, the war against cannabis is just that. I mean, it's one that's been waged, obviously, for decades as well. The discriminatory patterns are evident across all forms of drug use, drug sales, so on and so forth. So you're not going to get an argument from me on this issue. What I will say is that as long as we're focused on cannabis, we'll continue and only cannabis will continue to see discriminatory enforcement practices. Also, we need to look at the connection between drug use and drug abuse and property crimes or sales or prostitution, because there are a lot of people who are addicted to cocaine or to heroin, for example. Let me say addicted to cocaine or to heroin rather than having a cocaine abuse problem, who are stealing in order to finance their next fix, who are prostituting themselves, who are selling drugs themselves. And it is certainly true that African Americans suffer disproportionately from that reality as well. But I'm not focused on cannabis. I'm focused on all drug laws in this country.
Fascinating.
And let me not be defensive, but appreciate you for your remark about white people not being interested in ending racism. I have dear, in some cases, almost lifelong friends who are sick at heart over racism in this country, who feel the way many, I'm sure you and most of your listeners feel, about white supremacy and white superiority and the tendency on the part of so many of our institutions to perpetuate that reality. I recently heard a member of Black Lives Matter saying, when a question was asked, do you welcome white people into your movement? And the answer was, well, of course we do, but not white people who do not see white superiority, do not see white supremacy, and institutionalize racism as a problem. So, I'm not going to defend, even a portion of the white race. I'm just going to tell you who I hang out with, and I love them dearly, and they believe, as I do, that racism is an insidious and ugly reality and has been since the inception of this country.
What are the white people that you hang out with that, you know, they are genuinely sick about white supremacy? What types of things do they do? Like, do they make an effort to give up some of their power? Do they make an effort to do things specifically to address racism, white supremacy, to take some of the power that they have as a white person and do things to solve problems for black people? And if so, what do they do?
You know, they do. I mean, I'm not going to name names because I don't want to embarrass any of my friends. They may not want to be known as a friend of mine, but and I say that facetiously. But recently I talked to a woman who's involved in police oversight and who said not until white people give up some of their power, her term was share that power, until white people understand the impetus behind the Black Lives Movement and can articulate to a white cop why black lives matter, but blue lives don't matter, will we begin to see progress. And she happens to be married to an African-American man and who has been very actively involved in the political drama that has been the social movement that has been the reaction since Ferguson, since Michael Brown's death. And I'm talking about people who get arrested on protest lines, who actively agitate for an end to racism in this country. You know, whether I or other whites, or for that matter, African Americans, are doing the best that we can, whether we're doing the right strategies and tactics, is up for debate. But I think unless we have that debate, unless we ask ourselves, what is it going to take, in my particular context, to truly radically reform policing, as I said earlier, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 minutes from now, we could be back to the same conversation. I think policing must set, and I believe that the place to set it is at the federal level, standards for every aspect of procedural justice, stop and frisk, laws of arrest, search and seizure, and certainly use of force, including most obviously lethal force. There isn't a single standard anywhere in the country. We have law, we have Supreme Court decision, but we don't have standards. And as long as we don't, then, you know, and we, you know, I like to put it this way, we have 18,000 agencies and almost a million cops and one constitution. And that constitution is binding on every single police officer. And yet it is systematically abused across this country. And disproportionately, the victims of that abuse are people of color, and especially blacks.
I want to get my question in about Steve Silverman. I just want to point out to my question about what these white people do that are greatly pained, allegedly, about racism, what they do to solve problems and what have you. If it's just they do, because what I heard was just they do some talking about racism and they've got arrested and what have you. I've seen a lot of that for decades, all the way back to the hippies and beatniks in the 60s and what have you. And that, to me, does not qualify as sincere effort against racism. I just want to make sure I got that on the record.
But I respect your position. I'm sure your listeners do as well.
You referenced Steve Silverman. He's been a guest on our program repeatedly with Flex Your Rights. I recommend his documentaries all the time and tell people to check out his work. Extremely helpful. I use his suggestions regularly when I come in contact with enforcement officers. They work flawlessly every time. I just want to point out number three, because this has come up on the program before, where people have said the exact opposite of what he says, where they will say, if a police officer, they say, hey, can I look in your vehicle really quick? And they'll say, oh, sure, sure, thinking that they're de-escalating the situation. And I've had to interrupt people and hop in and say, oh, my God, that is terrible. Do not do that ever. That is the worst thing that you can do. You take his number three suggestion. Don't agree to a search ever. Saying no to searches is your constitutional right and probably your best move. Cops might search you anyway if you refuse, but your refusal can protect you later if you end up in court. And you continue, this is on the next page, 179. Gross violations of civil liberties almost always start with small, seemingly innocuous acts along the lines of, you don't mind if I search your car. I employed this as a rookie that have become second nature to many cops. Why, as a former chief of police, decades of experience as an enforcement officer, why do you co-sign on Mr. Silverman's suggestion that you never consent to a search?
Because in doing so, you're giving up your rights as an American citizen. By doing so, you're making police work a little too cheap and easy. Police officers must play by the rules. Police officers, when it comes to procedural justice, don't have leeway when it comes to the Constitution of the United States. They cannot stop you without reasonable suspicion that you have committed, are committing, or are about to commit a crime. And for Americans to just simply go along with that, and particularly people of color who are victimized by that practice more than others, is to really, you know, just give up our rights. And we ought not to be doing that. I used to say, as I've confessed many times, you don't have anything in your pockets you don't want me to see, do you? Well, and then oftentimes I would hear my fellow officers joke about it. You don't have any machine guns on you, so on and so forth. They're trying to make light of an abuse of the Constitution. So when Americans stand up for their rights they're forcing police officers, certainly at least in theory, to get more conscientious and more honest about police practices.
Mm.
And that would be refreshing.
I have used that one myself. It has worked flawlessly every time. I just make sure I encourage our listeners. You're not saying this like you have an army behind you. You're not saying this like you have backup that's going to come and support you. It's not with an attitude. You're courteous. You're polite. Officer, ma'am, sir, I know you're just doing your job. I do not consent to any searches of my person, my vehicle, my possessions without a warrant.
Yep.
That's it.
Yep.
It has worked flawlessly every time.
I think what you have done is confronted a police officer who is attempting a workaround against the Constitution. Not okay.
I concur. We had some people dialed in with questions. Do you have time to take a few quick callers?
I can take a few, sure.
Alrighty. Let's see if we can get everybody just get quickly to your question. That way we can see if we can get as many calls in as we can from Mr. Norm Stamper. M1, you had a hand up. Did you have a question for Mr. Stamper?
Oh, yes. How's everything?
Well, sir, did
can you
have
hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yes. So Mr. Stamper, how can people who say they're pro-police be more angry at a song by Beyonce on police issues than they are about white cop killers who have killed 20 cops this year?
Well, if I understand your question correctly, it's certainly true that a lot of white police officers and police unions have rebelled against Beyonce's performance at Super Bowl. It gave me goosebumps, and I don't mind admitting that. All the way back to 1968 Olympics, when two black athletes raised their fists as a sign of protest, as a sign of black power, I felt the same way. It's like, we are Americans. We have a right to express ourselves. And, I guess police officers are saying, well, we have a right not to like what she did. But calls for boycotts and so on and so forth, I think more often than not backfire in a situation like this. Yeah, white police officers say don't buy her CDs and that sort of thing. But we're Americans. We have a right to assemble. We have a right to express ourselves.
Hmm. Caller at a block number, did you have a question for Mr. Norm Stamper? You should be with us. Caller dialing in from a block number. Are you just listening, or did you have a question?
Sorry, can I hear?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, sorry about that. First and foremost, we have heard on the line, Mr. Stamper, you have said repeatedly this evening the term white superiority. What do you mean by that?
I mean something that is almost a part of the central nervous system of many whites. I own my own racism. I own the effects of white privilege. I get it. I have been through a whole lot of education and training put on by some wonderful African-American and other instructors over the years, over the decades, as a matter of fact. I was even at a diversity training class back in the late 60s in which white cops walked out because they were so offended. And what were they offended at? They were offended at a black professor saying, you don't even know how privileged you are. You are utterly unconscious of white privilege, of white superiority. So for me, it is something that is, if not embedded in the DNA of whites, it certainly has become part of the central nervous system of individuals who won't look at the issue, who won't ask themselves, with all of the pain that might be associated with it, am I a racist? And if so, what am I going to do about it?
Hmm. Hmm. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Mr. Stamper?
Yes, I do. Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, man, I'm still going from the last answer. Question for you, sir. Good evening, Mr. Stanford, first. Good evening, guys.
Good evening.
If white people were being abused by any other race of people, do you think that they would look for a nonviolent solution?
Well, obviously that was an earlier theme. I'm just telling you, I've staked my position. I've planted my stake, and I believe very strongly that violence is not the answer. And I'm talking about, I start with and I agree with the premise that what has brought us to where we are today is white supremacy and police violence. I absolutely believe that. And I also believe that shooting at unknown police officers, not in self-defense, not for any other reason than attempting to assassinate them, is just, it's just plain wrong, and I do believe that it's counterproductive. Do I get why people feel motivated to do that? Surely, of course I do. I've seen too much up close and personal. I've read too much. I've watched some wonderful movies that help to illuminate the ugly chapters of our history as Americans. So I'm opposed to the violence, even as I understand it.
I don't think you answered his question, though. I think his question was white people, the white race, when they have been attacked or mistreated, them responding nonviolent, being dedicated to a nonviolent response when they felt aggrieved or mistreated. I think that was the question.
Well, I think we'd have to go some to find a chapter in the history of whites, Europeans, for example, or the Western Hemisphere, to find an example of how whites have been mistreated by others. If you've got a chapter of that history, I'd be interested in hearing it. I think, generally speaking, one of the reasons that whites do feel that many whites do feel superior is that they've never had to contend with this issue. And yet people of color around the globe have had to contend with the issue.
Might throw 9/11, but the caller at 9516. Did you have a question for Mr. Stamper? You should be with us. Your volume is. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, Mr. Stamper, what logical reason do non-white black people have to trust the police or any other white person after centuries of being brutalized and terrorized by the police and other whites?
I'm sorry. I can't hear you. It's a volume thing, I think. Could you repeat the question, or maybe Gus, if you could restate
it? Sorry. Can you hear me clear now, Mr. Sanders?
Oh yes, that's much better. Thank you.
Okay. The question was: what reason do non-white black people have to trust the police or any other white people after centuries of being brutalized and terrorized by white people and police?
That's almost impossible for me to answer. I think it's a terribly important question. I'm not trying to skirt it. I'm just trying to say that as a white person, I don't have an answer to that question. I can tell you what, in my in my vision for a very different kind of future from the past that we've had in this country, It would boil down to faith, and I'm not talking about religious faith, although I certainly have room in my worldview for those who subscribe to a religious faith, but a faith in the power of protest, in the power of a citizens' movement that would create enough pressure to bend this very formidable institution that we call policing. A faith in like-mindedness of those who say it's time to put an end to racism, to excessive force, to unjustified lethal force. It's time for the police to become the people's police. And I don't mean just the, you know, the blind, loyal supporters of police, but those who have for generations been afraid of, angry at, highly critical of the police.
The caller at 5640, did you have a question for Mr. Stamper?
Yes. Good evening to Gus and to Mr. Stamper.
Good evening.
Hi. Have you ever visited the National Police Officers Memorial in Washington, D.C.? And if so, what were your impressions? If not, why not?
I did Yes, thank you very much. I did visit that memorial. It was when one of my officers in Seattle, Antonio Terry, was shot and killed. He's an African-American man. He was shot and killed by another African-American man in the line of duty. So I went to the memorial service. I accompanied Antonio's family, and I almost wish I could avoid talking about this, but there were members of a big city police department, namely the New York City Police Department, who were staying at the same hotel as the grieving family and yours truly, and they behaved like a drunken fraternity. They basically tore the hotel apart. They hit the fire alarms at 3 o'clock in the morning when the families are getting ready in just a couple of hours to go out to the memorial service for the officers. So it was a very surreal experience for me that police officers would behave that way. I've been around cops long enough to know I was one, long enough to know certainly during my earlier days on the job when you know, act like a horse's ass, to put it kindly. But that they would do it under those circumstances was just, you know, beyond the pale.
Mm. Roz, did you have a question for Mr. Stamper? Roz, you should be with us.
Yes, greetings to you, Gus, and greetings to you, Mr. Stamper.
Greetings to you.
Yes, I did have a question. My question is, are the police, in your opinion, being used to refine racism and white supremacy via the use of body cameras, specifically regarding the constant videos of black death and the repeated showing of those videos having an anesthetizing effect on the officers that are taking lives? Thank you.
Oh, that's such a good question. That got to me. I would hope that no human being would experience an anesthetizing effect of the Michael Slager shooting of Walter Scott, for example, in North Charleston, South Carolina. That was a cold-blooded murder. The same certainly was true of the Laquan McDonald shooting in Chicago. I would hope that every cop, certainly every police chief, every police union leader who sees something like that would be enraged and would demand justice. Now, in both of those cases, and I think it's probably more because they're such blatant cases, the officers have been charged with murder. And I think we just need to be very real about conducting accurate, thorough investigations and letting the chips fall where they may. And that does mean charging far more officers than we have in the past for these crimes that they commit against their fellow citizens. It's just, I'm still struck by the nature of that question. To think that, and you're right, I mean, you're absolutely right. You see something often enough, you become numb to it. Unless I suspect you happen to be, a black parent of a 14-year-old boy that you'd like to see survive into adulthood and die a natural death after many years of living life to the fullest. You know, we're talking about the sanctity of human life, and when police officers deny human life unjustifiably, I need to point out, then they need to pay a very stiff price for that, the same price that a citizen would pay. if not a steeper one, because they're doing it under color of authority.
Hmm. Caller in Michigan, did you have a question for Mr. Stamper?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening to the callers and to Mr. Stamper. Well, my question has something to do with the body cameras as well. And I just wondered, what was your, you know, you're not a police officer now, but would you have been opposed to wearing a body camera? Or what is your position on the use of the body cameras and or the video recording of these incidents by citizens of police officers?
Yeah, let me start with
after that.
Okay, let me start with the role of the citizen. Citizens have an absolute right. The court has ruled to take photographs, to do video recordings of police interactions. They do not have a right to interfere, and a lot of judgment needs to be exercised all around under those circumstances. But they do have a right to film police officers. And you see these officers putting their hands up in front of cameras, or worse, taking the camera, smashing the camera in some cases. That's wrong. It's against the law for police officers to do that. I was opposed to cameras early on. Back in the day, I was asked the question, and I referenced this in my book. I was in West Seattle community of the city of Seattle, and as I recall this, and a citizen said, well, what do you think of putting cameras on police officers? Well, at the time, we didn't have the miniaturization issue that or a capability that we have today. So I had this vision of police officers, much like, you know, news camera people with big cameras recording their interactions with the citizens. And I was opposed, even if, I suppose, if somebody said, well, we can miniaturize it and make it so small that you could actually clip it to the chest or the hat of a police officer or glasses of a police officer. I would have opposed it as well all the way back then, because it struck me as invasive of the privacy of our citizens. Oftentimes, police officers are encountering citizens under less than desirable circumstances, when they're not exactly at their best, when they are experiencing grief or heartache or jealousy or insecurity or whatever. And I thought, invasion of privacy, I don't think I like this. Then for a number of months, maybe a couple of years, I don't remember now, I took kind of a more neutral position, and eventually, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, I came to the conclusion that not only should we go to body cameras, we must, because they have shown, in a couple of instances, they've shown police officers doing the right thing. So it vindicated them, it validated what they chose to do. In other cases, we've seen police officers on camera misbehaving, to use that euphemism, and it's evidence. And it's technology that we need to be taking advantage of. So all around, whether it's a citizen in possession of a camera or a police officer in possession of a camera, I think it represents an advancement. We still need to be very much attuned to the policies and the procedures, the retention of videos, the evidence of value and risks associated with all aspects of evidence gathering and making sure that we have a reputable, reliable system. But I'm a fan now.
Just trying to nab as many of the callers as we can while we have Mr. Stamper with us. The caller at 3246, 3246, did you have a question for Mr. Stamper?
Yes, sir. Hello.
Greetings.
Yes. So my question is, if you don't mind, I'm going to be really quick, just put it into context. There's a lot of things that are confusing for me in this world. For example, I don't know what a white people is. I don't know what a white supremacy is. But there is a group that came out of Europe after the last ice age, and I have identified that group. And they have been terrorizing, or everything they do, every breath they take, is terrorizing the entire planet. My question is, not how you stop white supremacy, because, again, I don't even know what a white supremacy is. What I do know is this group that came out of Europe after the last ice age is causing problems. So I have a question for the people who classify as white, the people who actually came out of Europe during the last ice age. How can they stop white supremacy? You know, if you could give like a one sentence answer for that, and then maybe explain. And then the other question is, how can black people stop the terroristic behavior of this group of people who came out of Europe after the last ice age? And then the question is,
you said you had one question.
I want this done within a year. That's it. Thank you.
The short answer is, and it's not a satisfactory one, I don't know. I mean, I have no idea. I'm assuming that you're talking about a core group of white people out of Europe following the Ice Age. I do know that genetic studies, this is just from my reading to satisfy curiosity, that genetic studies have essentially concluded that we are all one race. And that for a wide variety of reasons, most of them geographical, but and meteorological, I guess, as well, we now occupy different skin color. We occupy obviously different cultures, different languages, differences that I think make the world a truly wonderful place. I see color, and I celebrate diversity. I enjoy it in my personal life. I'm working closely with an African-American woman right now who is, and we live, the two of us, live in a community of about 4,500. And until very recently, it was almost all lily white. And we want to encourage others to consider moving here, people who don't look like me. So I don't know the answer to your question. I think what we need to understand is the humanity that unites us all.
Retired firefighter in Florida, did you have a question for Mr. Stamper? You should be with us.
Yes. I would like to expand the conversation to a global level when it comes to law enforcement. There are forces that are controlled by white people that have these huge and devastating military forces that has every mode of weaponry that can destroy everybody within the known universe. And in turn, when it comes to rules of engagement, white people make all of the decisions. Now, my question is, would it be correct for those people who are primarily non-white people to not accept any suggestions from white people on what level of violence that they may take into neutralizing this too long process that's been against them? Do you think that would be correct?
I do not. I think it would be correct, if I understand your question correctly. I think the biggest problem that I have with what you're suggesting is that there are many police officers who have knowledge, skill, experience, technical expertise, who are skilled at de-escalation techniques, not using weapons at all, even in some cases where they'd be justified. And I think it would be foolhardy not to tap that experience and that wisdom. Equally foolhardy would be the belief on the part of white police officers, you know, whether they self-identify as superior or see themselves as some kind of supreme entity in the lives of their communities, that police officers who are not listening to the will of the people, and let's put it in a black and white context, who are not listening to what black people have to say about levels of violence in their community, whether it be from crime or at the hands of police, are making an equally large mistake. Somehow, we got to figure out how to talk to one another, how to trust one another. This is not going to happen by Tuesday of next week, but how to come together to agree on how we achieve safe streets, safe homes, safe schools, and healthy neighborhoods. How do we do that? How do we do that within the context of our history, which is very sordid and ugly? How do we do that when too many of my brothers and sisters in white America believe that they are right and that they are superior as a result of their being right? And for them, at some subconscious level, if not conscious level, white is might. And that's just as wrong can be.
Devin in Florida, did you have a question for Mr. Stamper? Devin in Florida.
Absolutely. Good evening, everybody.
Evening.
How you doing, Gus?
Good evening.
Mr. Stamper, good evening. I wanted to ask you a quick question, and that question is, how exactly do you practice white supremacy?
How do I practice it?
Yes.
I'm not conscious of how I practice it. That's in the nature of white privilege. I don't have to look over my shoulder when I walk into a pharmacy to see whether security is tailing me. I can get as scared as any other person of any other color when I see blue and red lights in my rear view mirror, for example. But I know that the likelihood of my being shot is much less than that of a black person stopped by the police. I guess what I'm saying is I don't have to go through my life thinking about my whiteness and what it means. I believe, based on countless conversations with so many black people, that is not their truth, that they have to think about it, they have to feel it, they have to go to bed with it, they have to get up with it in the morning, they have to be mindful of it when they teach their children how to get along in this world, and especially with police, but also with teachers and with other authority figures. So, once again, I don't know if my questions or my answer is very satisfying.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Just to make sure that I understand you correctly, want me to believe that you wrote that book, Breaking Rank, which masterfully articulated the practice of white supremacy from some of your colleagues and that were enforcement officials? So you want me to believe that you're totally unconscious in how you practice personally white supremacy today in 2016?
No, I totally record and register your objection to what I'm saying, your resistance to what I'm saying, but I'm also asserting to you that I am not, as I go about my daily life, conscious of white supremacy inside me. I can choose to believe it doesn't dwell in my heart or in my soul. I can believe that is not who I am. And frankly, I do believe that about me, but I am not naive enough to know the tendency for me right now is to tell you a very long story, but I won't. That has to do with my father. But I will tell you that I think white supremacy resides in the fact that whites don't even think about it, because we are not conscious of it. I've done a tremendous amount of soul searching. I set out to be as different from my father as I possibly could, who used every racially bigoted term in the book for most of the days of my early life. How is it possible that I escaped, not being affected by that kind of a, quote, education? And so I've done a lot of deep level work. I've done some soul searching, and I'm still telling you, I don't know. I mean, I really don't. I don't want to be, but I know that as a white person, I've got it in me. I don't think it just evaporated. I worked at it, but it's not completely gone as a function of my intellectual knowledge about the unconscious. Consciously, it's not there. Unconsciously, of course, it's there.
The caller at 0748-0748. Did you have a question for Mr. Stamper?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings to Gus, the host, Mr. Stamper, the listeners and callers. Really quick, I had a question. Is there a reason why the color black is used for the uniforms on police officers, Mr. Stamper, along with all of the other, like, the shoes and the weapons and whatnot? Is there any symbolism behind that, to your knowledge?
There is not, to my knowledge, and I can tell you that police officers wear a wide variety of uniforms throughout the country. They wear tan, they wear green, they wear khaki, whatever that difference is. They wear, some cases, brown shoes, black duty belts, brown duty belts, brown hats. There's a real mixture out there. But yes, the traditional colors of the duty belt that we used to call a gun belt and the shoes is black. And in fact, when you see officers dressed up like ninjas during major demonstrations, that uniform is either a deep navy or a black. But I don't know of any concerted effort on the part of anyone, to list those as specifications for the uniform. I do know, just from growing up in this country, that people, going all the way back to the Western days, that the black hats were supposed to be worn by the bad guys and the white hats by the good guys. And a lot of people scoff at that, but symbolism is important. And maybe that is an early indication of how we came to conceive of blackness and whiteness, badness and goodness.
The caller at 5992.
I guess maybe time for one more. I hate to cut off the conversation. I'm really enjoying. I'm learning so much from it, but I do have to leave here in just a moment.
Right on. 5992. Did you have a question for Mr. Stamper? Caller at 5992. Can you hear us? Are you just listening, or did you have a question? Last check, 5992. Are you just listening? Right on. We'll check. Last call from our caller in Canada. Did you have a question for Mr. Stamper?
Yes. Good evening, Mr. Stanford. My question is, considering that you acknowledge that to end white supremacy, we have to alter the structure, would that not mean that instead of reforming policing, that we have to dismantle the institution of policing in favor of alternate forms of protection, accountability, community systems?
My position on reform versus revolution is, if you force me to pick one, I'm picking revolution. I'm also recognizing that there are certain traditions in police work that are well worth preserving. And I would be remiss if I didn't say that. I wish I had a lot of time to explain from my point of view, the life-saving and other, not just heroic, but sensitive, compassionate, empathetic work that goes on by police officers in spite of the system. I am all about not tinkering with the system, not tweaking the system. I am all about radical restructuring of the institution. When I hear the word dismantling, I conjure the picture of no police. And there are very serious and very intellectually rigorous individuals, some of whom I consider colleagues, if not personal friends, because we haven't met yet, I've only read their work, who are in fact, advocating completely dismantling police work and building the institution anew from the ground up. Intellectually, I can support that. As a practical matter, too much violence, too many emergencies, too many 3 a.m. calls that are truly of life and death nature, and I just cannot wrap my mind around the idea that we abolish the institution and start over. I think what we need to do is shake it from the ground up, and the shaking needs to be done by a combination of a strong citizens movement with like-minded, sympathetic members of the institution and local community activists and civic leaders and so forth, who are in agreement that tampering and tweaking the system is not going to cut it.
You're just saying just buckets and buckets of words.
Right on. Context of white supremacy, Mr. Norm Stamper. Before you exit, the last time when you were here with us in 2014, that was in the middle of the Ferguson upheaval when you were on the program, and you shared that when you were an enforcement official, I think you were talking specifically about when you were in San Diego, that one of the ways that you at that time possibly practiced white supremacy racism, you would kind of bait suspect, a civilian, you would bait them, either say things to kind of get them upset or what have you, so they would get riled up, and then you would have justifications if you wanted to arrest them, take them in, or whatever the case may be. And they said, now that you're writing these books, you're retired, have you done anything to correct those arrests where you might have falsely arrested someone or kind of baited them into doing something so that you could go ahead, handcuff them, take them in? Have you done anything to try to correct that and or set aside any proceeds from the book to compensate any of these folks that might have been arrested wrongly while you were an enforcement official?
Well, these folks were, for the most part, adults, young adults, middle-aged adults in 1966. And the short answer is no. I have not done that, nor do I plan to do that. I've carved out a course for my life that is all about social justice, and I'm working hard toward that end. And I believe very strongly in giving back to the community, and I do that through my own giving, most of it to social justice causes. But I wouldn't know where to begin, Gus, to find out who that 19-year-old white kid was that I arrested falsely in 1966 or 67, or the young man I choked out, using the vernacular of that day and of today in too many agencies. I wouldn't even know where to begin. Don't know their names, don't know whether they're alive today. But my atonement work takes the form of saying, I did wrong. I abused the people I was hired to serve. There's no excuse for that. And I've dedicated the balance of my life from the late 60s to this moment, and will to the grave, to helping to achieve social justice.
Mm. Right on, Mr. Norm Stamper, author of Breaking Rank, the latest book to protect and serve, former Seattle police chief, 3 decades as an enforcement official. Thank you kindly for hanging out this Wednesday evening. We will look forward to having you back on the program. One of the folks, guests always enjoy hearing your views and getting an opportunity to ask a few questions. We will look forward to hearing from you again in the future, Mr. Stamper.
Thank you very much, Gus.
Yes, sir. Context evening. Context of white supremacy. Norm Stamper, his fourth visit on the cows. I did not get it in just because I was trying to rush to get as many callers in as I could for the time that we had Mr. Stamper. But the online server is back up, so people that are accustomed to listening to the cows on TuneIn or Black Talk Radio Network or wherever you listen to the cows. We are live streaming. It is back up and functional. So if you dialed in via the phone line to listen in, you can hang up, I guess, if you are so interested. And you can just go back to listening online if you prefer to just hang out on the phone. That is fine too. I hope it didn't throw people off too much. I tried to let people know via Facebook and Twitter that we were having some server problems. Kudos to Mr. Scotty Reed, founder of the Black Talk Radio Network, for getting the problem corrected. You got it finished some time ago so that people could go back to listening online. But it is up and working. Again, Black Talk Radio Network. It's linked on the Facebook page. You can listen on TuneIn as well, and the archives will be pristine if you missed any portion of the program. Mr. Stamper and his questions, responses, answers throughout the broadcast, the archives will be perfect. So you can just catch the archive a few about an hour after the live broadcast concludes. Context of White Supremacy. I can plug, the archives are available. You can get it at iTunes. You can get it at Stitcher. You can get it at Blueberry. You can get it at Black Talk Radio Network. Myriad of different spots available. I've been posting them online and tweeting them out. Where you can subscribe at iTunes, and it will just update. If you subscribe, it'll just update to your iTunes or your iPod or wherever you subscribe at via iTunes. If you have a mobile device, Blueberry, same thing. Stitcher, same thing. You can just get the app with Blueberry or Stitcher, and they'll just update as the new episodes become available. If you have problems, if you're trying to find Mr. Stamp or some of his other visits to the cows, this is his fourth time with us. Just drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. And we can hook you up. If you cannot find something in the archives, we'll hook you up as best we can. Quick comments, and then we'll get commentary from folks who dialed in. If you all have anything you would like to share based on what you heard from Mr. Stamper. Man, oh man. I have submitted that before in terms of when they began to reference other victims of white supremacy, in terms of where they get their expertise. A lot of what we heard from Mr. Stamper, I could just reduce it to two of the main ways, in my view, that whites practice racism, white supremacy. The mythology, the lie, the major bit of deception that whites are ignorant, that they're unaware, that they're unconscious, that they are just dopes about white supremacy, racism. That is one tenet. And the other tenet, that somehow they are going to solve this problem, that they're going to go out and protest and invite black people to their neighborhoods and or engage in sexual intercourse with black people, that in somehow, some way, there are at least a small cadre of whites that are working to solve this problem. And we're going to get there. John Brown, Jane Elliott, God bless them. We're going to help get here at some point. And I've said this consistently all the way back to the White Privilege Conference. Once, in my view, as non-white people, those are two of the main elements that, you know, really have to get clarity about, that white people are not, cannot be ignorant about white supremacy, racism, that that is folly of the greatest order. They do not need to go and listen to any victim of racism talk for a day, an hour, a semester about racism. As Mr. Fuller says consistently, the typical white person, by the time they are 15 years old, they have got a PhD understanding of racism, white supremacy. They are around whites that are talking about this problem all the time, that are articulating their views on what it means to be white, expectations of you as an individual classified as white, what they think about people that are classified as non-white, especially black people. This is happening all the time. All areas of people, activity, their moms, grandparents, uncles, aunts, sisters, cousins, friends, neighbors, pastors, whatever the case may be, they are getting this information constantly. Ignorance about racism is one of the lamest excuses, and in my view, it is one of their strongest weapons, because it encourages a lot of non-white people to think erroneously that if we can just educate whites, they'll solve this problem. If we can just write the correct book, point them to the right information, get them to the White Privilege Conference, get them a few Timothy Wise books, that this will solve the problem. Nothing could be further from the truth. And it's connected, these two, that white people are ignorant and that white people are going to at some point voluntarily stop practicing racism. Again, that is total nonsense. And in my view, racists, they really need non-white people to invest in these lies, heavily invest, that white people, at least some of them, they're willing to stop practicing racism, and that if they get the correct information, they will reform, rehabilitate their terroristic behavior. It is simply not true. And I've stated consistently for years, when you come to an accurate understanding about this, it radically alters how you go about trying to solve this problem in terms of what you are expecting from whites, how you invest your time and energy. When you have incorrect ways of thinking about this problem and thinking that whites can be reformed, rehabilitated, it sends you off in a lot of false directions. And they know this. They know. Norm Stamper understands this clearly. You've been an enforcement official for 30 years. Man, you for sure are not ignorant about racism. One of the other main things that stood out to me in this conversation, I have maintained for a long time, as someone who has done a bit of traveling in the U.S., I've lived on both coasts. I have gone to most of the states in the U.S. The whites in Seattle are a different type of refined. We've had quite a few whites on this program from the Seattle area. Mr. Stamper's been here several times. Dorothy Bullitt, remember her from the beginning of the year, the white woman. She did the article in the Seattle Times. She was talking about her family owned enslaved black people, terrorized black people. She did the article talking about that. She came on the program and talked about how she went to Garfield High School in the 60s. She was one of the few whites that went there, and how the black people mistreated her and all this. We had her, we had Stephen Bezruchko, white guy. He's a professor at the University of Washington. We had the class of white students from the University of Washington. We have had a number of whites on this program over the years. I think you can go and you can listen, and you can hear the refinement in the way that they talk about racism, white supremacy, the terms that they will use, how they have learned so much from black people, and being around black people has educated them. It's almost like they have a whole different level of codification in the way that they function, speak about racism, white supremacy in this area of the world. Again, there are not a whole lot of black people in Washington state on the whole and or Seattle. That's less than 10% of the population in Seattle. Is black people, certainly in the state of Washington, way less than 10% of the state population is black people. I think that is a major influence, a major variable in terms of the refinement that you see amongst individuals classified as white in this area. If you go back and listen, I can pick out some of the episodes we've had whites from this area of the world. I think you will notice a lot of patterns. I mentioned that earlier in the year when we had whites from this area of the world on. Anyone, if you've listened to the cows over the years, if you can recall some of the whites from this area of the world, I think those patterns will stick out. Not that you don't hear some of the same rhetoric and buckets of words from other racists, suspected racists that we've had on the program, because you certainly do, but it's a little different. It's even something I suspect I could write it out to be very clear in what I'm hearing, which you will observe from whites in this part of the world. I thought it was telling, was probably worthy of a cowbell when he said that he worked with a black female in the area of the world, the part of Washington state that he lives in here. I think he's on the San Juan Islands. He said it's like 4,500 people. And he said Lily White was the term that he used, and that it was a black female there. She's like probably the only black female. White suggests that sort of thing all the time, that that will solve the problem of racism, white supremacy. That is very, very common, that if we just hang out together, generally lead to some sort of bedroom integration, tragic arrangements, that that will solve the problem of white supremacy, racism. Again, that is total nonsense. And in my view, that is just setting up a situation for more terrorism. I cannot imagine anything being constructive about being one black person in an area with about 4,500 whites and you're the only black person. I cannot imagine anything being constructive, healthy about that at all. Whites have even done studies. Dr. Darren Smith, he was on the program. He's been on a couple times where he shared the information about they have data that black people, folks with melanin just having contact with whites is not healthy. They will suggest that. And again, a lot of this, a lot of their deception, a lot of the rhetoric that you will hear when you talk to these whites, when they're really refined and they can drop white privilege and I'm not conscious and blah, blah, blah. And I read this book and I went to this conference and all that. A lot of it, it is designed for folks who do not have an understanding of racism, white supremacy, and just the power of them being white. We've talked about this before. You don't want to challenge whites. You don't want to question whites. You don't want to think that this person is actually lying to me right now and practicing racism within the conversation. That's what's happening. And I think when we're confused about racism, white supremacy, we're white identified. We're searching for the good white person. We think, hey, this Mr. Stamper guy, some of the things that he shares, he does have accurate information in some of the things that he's talking about. So we think, hey, this is one of the good ones. He's trying not to be racist. He's trying to help solve this problem. No. 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 You can pick out some of the good information, like the pit that he talked about in terms of always refuse a search from enforcement officers. That is constructive information, in my view. If you have a different view, no problem. But in my view, that is constructive. I have suggested that for years on the program. We had Steve Silverman, who he quoted in his book. We had him on the program. He is a suspected race soldier as well. But that is extremely important. And he detailed how that's one of the ways whites practice racism. When you go ahead and okay that search, they can feel free. Anything that they find, oh, now I got grounds to do whatever I want. If I find something, if I plant something in your vehicle or on your person, oh, look what I found in your backpack or what have you, and now we get to cuff you and all that other stuff. Always, ma'am, sir, officer, I know you're just doing your job. I do not consent to any searches of my person, my property, my vehicle without a warrant. I have done that myself. It has worked flawlessly every time. That is the codified suggestion in my view. Not, no, I don't have anything. Feel free to, no, you do not want to do that under any circumstances. That is a bad move always. But like I said, white, and it's not just Mr. Stamper. Many whites, they will have some constructive information from time to time. They might even give you one or two accurate details about racism, white supremacy, but it's also going to be mixed in with a lot of falsehood and deception. And I think that's what we got. If we had had more time, there were a lot of callers, so I was just trying to hurry to get as many folks through as possible. Then you can tease out, you can stop, you can redirect, you can ask questions about terms and what you said. Is that accurate? Is that true? There are many, many times him saying, many times. I'm sure you all can pick that out. Anyway, I will pause there. If folks have questions that they would like to ask or commentary based on what you heard, feel free. The number is 641-715-3640. The code 564-943. Pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. I would only reiterate any white person, not just Mr. Stamper, where they say, and it's not even like, because I've been very clear when he made his comment about it was a black officer killed in Dallas, in Baton Rouge. I pointed that out. It was a black civilian who was shot. She was not fatally injured, but it was a black mother who was injured in the Dallas shooting 2 weeks ago. I have pointed that out and the incorrectness of that. That being said, in my view, it is an astronomical act of white supremacy, deliberate, conscious, knowing act of white supremacy. Anytime a white person says that, oh, you niggers have to be nonviolent in going about solving this problem, that is absurd. That is an act of racism, should be recognized and called out as such. Like I said, you have individuals that whites don't say Ta-Nehisi Coates is radical and crazy. Most of them, many of them, they spend a lot of time validating his work and saying that he's great and he's done all this fabulous scholarship. He has written about that. I will post it saying the exact same thing. Whites saying that it is a massive act of racism. When they get their nigger knocker, according to Mr. Stamper, they get their nigger knocker and you're going upside black people's head all the time. Collective systemic terrorism against black people. And then say, whoa, 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 wait a minute. What are you talking about that you're going to be violent? No. You have to be nonviolent and peaceful in how you go about. No. Massive act of racism, white supremacy. And they will do the same slick thing. Quote some non-white people. That's another one. Quote some victims. Throw Martin Luther King Jr.'s name out. Throw Nelson Mandela's name out, even though he certainly was not always about nonviolence, or whomever else, other victims of racism, to try to make it seem like they have the moral high ground, as they say, that you have to be nonviolent. That is total nonsense, particularly when whites are dedicated eternally to the practice of white supremacy. And they know this. None of this is white ignorance. Again, I've written about that. That is a major act of white deception. Anywho, getting to the phone lines, I guess it would be correct for me to go to the people who did not get to get a question in at all, because we almost got everybody who dialed in. I was really pleased because we were able to go quickly. So we almost got everybody. So I think there were only maybe one or two people, maybe three, but I think we got pretty much everybody. Thanks, everyone, for being quick, right to the point with your questions. The caller at 3844, did you have a question since we didn't hear from you? I don't think. 3844, did you have a question, comment you wanted to get in?
Yes, my question was just for you. I wanted to know who was the man that was saying it was unhealthy to even be around white people. I couldn't catch the name.
Dr. Darren Smith. He's a black male. Dr. Darren Smith. He was on the program twice, and I think it was the second time he was on the program, which was in, if memory is, my memory is accurate, it was January of 2014. But he was referencing, he gave more detail while he was on the program. But he just said that they have done studies where just being in the presence of whites for black people is unhealthy. And they have the data to evidence that this is not just somebody talking or what have you, that they have went and researched this, and the research shows that it is not healthy for black people to be in contact with whites. This is Dr. Darren Smith. Dr. Darren Smith.
All right. Thanks a lot.
The caller at two, I'm going to get everybody else. Like I said, I think it would be correct to try to get the people that didn't get a question. 2534, did you have a, I guess, comment that you wanted to make sure you got in? 2534.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and the listeners. I just wanted to comment on the guest that was on tonight, Steve Tasser. At the end of the interview, I definitely suspect that he was practicing racism when he was speaking on. He has a vision of, when somebody says dismantle, that he has a vision of there being no police, that like there being a policeless society. And the reason I felt like he was practicing racism, because by his talk and the books that he writes and things like that, he has to know that policing was founded on slave catching. So if it's founded on slave catching, you know it's wrong from the beginning. So to say that dismantling it is like saying it's the wrong thing, that he doesn't see. When he hears dismantling, he hears no policing in the society. That, to me, I don't know about anybody else, but that to me says that he's practicing racism, because he knows the foundings of it was racist. It is racism. It's slave catching. So I just wanted to point that out, and I guess ask you as well. Did you feel that way? Did you catch that? And I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
Yes, sir. Totally correct. He does know. That's why I said white people are not ignorant about white supremacy, racism. Nothing could be further from the truth. He brought that up several times during the earlier portion of the program, that the foundation of policing in this part of the world was the enslavement of black people. It's in his most recent book, To Protect and Serve. When he was on Democracy Now! Last week, he pointed that out as well. He's not ignorant about racism. So he absolutely understands that is the entire structure. The foundation is white supremacy, racism, and it's not just policing. It is the entirety, all areas of people activity. It is the entire world as it has been constructed as it relates to people is about practicing racism, white supremacy, whites dominating everyone that they say are not white. So I'm sure that I know he understands that. And I would just say that there were so many different times and ways, in my view, that he was not being honest, accurate about racism, white supremacy. That, you know, was just one of many, in my view. I think some of the listeners, I think they recognize that as well. Even the insertion of the word white privilege, in my view, because I had not been using that term. And I think at least one of the times where he strategically employed it, when I think it was the caller in Florida, Devin, where he asked him, well, how have you personally practiced racism? And he inserted the word white privilege that I'm not aware. I'm not conscious. I can't be. I, you know, took a class where black people told me, you know, yada, yada, yada. And that's just a part of, you know, how I function as a white person. It's there, but I'm just not aware. That another asset. And this is from someone who carried a nigger knocker as an enforcement official and wrote about carrying a nigger knocker as an enforcement official. Let's see, I think that might be everybody. If I missed anybody, you know, you can just let me know, but I think that might be everybody that dialed in that did not get a question. So I will nab the other folks who dialed in who did get to ask a question. If you have commentary that you would like to share, observations, if you did, you don't think he answered your question adequately, or just comments on his other observations. I did want to point out as well, because I think that is important. That's something I think M1 and some of our other listeners have noted in terms of white cop killers. I think M1 asked a question about Beyonce, that there was more focus and attention on her Super Bowl performance and her song about police terrorism against black people as opposed to white cop killers. That is another point that I think should be pointed out all the time, because I didn't even know who Curtis Ayers was until like today. I went because there was a shooting in Kansas. I think like this week, yesterday, since the Baton Rouge thing, there was a shooting in Kansas where an enforcement official was shot and killed. They didn't identify who they think the suspect were. I think they had some suspects in custody. They didn't name them. They didn't identify them. And I said, I think these are whites, because I think they would, with this climate, their picture would have been everywhere. Name, photograph, the whole nine. Now, this is real fluid, so it might be coming and then they'll just add it to it. But I strongly suspect that these are whites. But what led me to that was that within the report about the shooting that happened this week in Kansas, they referenced the one that happened in May, which I also hadn't heard about. And when I further looked, it was like, oh, Curtis Ayers, this is a white guy. They got his photograph, everything. He shot, killed an officer, stole his car and everything, went out rolling and riding around doing all this other stuff, terrorizing people. He's facing the death penalty in Kansas. That happened this year before the Dallas thing. Not a peep. I think that's something that should be pointed out consistently, because it just reveals, in my view, the total hypocrisy. It's not that we care about enforcement officials. We just want to use this towards our ends so that we can further justify violence, terrorism against black people. The niggers are acting wild and killing cops, so we have to strengthen our terror on the plantation to get them in line. When white people go out and do this, whatever. Negros, that is something that we can use politically, strengthen our rhetoric, and they know how. I mean, they have done this for years. That's how Assata Shakur, 40, 50 years on? That's how she is the number one, the first female on the FBI's terrorist most wanted list, in association her alleged killing of an enforcement official. That's why they're still bringing that up in New Jersey, saying that they don't want to restore relations with Cuba, because you got this negress down here in Cuba hiding out, this cop killer, and we need to get her and drag her back here right now so she can finish out her sentence. It's only applied to black people. It's not that they care about enforcement officials, in my opinion. It's they care about maintaining white supremacy. But other folks who dialed in, if you had commentary, thoughts on what you heard from Mr. Stamper, you should be with us.
Oh, yes. Hello. Go ahead, sir. Go ahead.
You can go first, sir. Okay, I'll go on. Yeah, I think that he was textbook. He laid out the white privilege argument just as well as anyone could. I mean, it was textbook. As being someone aware, you know, I enjoyed his commentary because I was just cracking up. Like, I mean, this guy can't be serious. I think that I'm going to use this episode and I'm going to send it to my cousin, who just graduated from college, and she's very idealistic, and she tried to come at me recently with that white privilege argument, and I shut that down pretty quickly. But I think that this just sounds how stupid it sounds. You know, you're the chief of police, man. You're, like you said, walking around with a nigger knocker, and you're just, like, talking about you're totally unaware. This is just some subconscious thing that happens. Just utterly ridiculous. I think that he definitely didn't answer my question, but he didn't really answer anyone's question. He just came with a lot of, as you played the clip, buckets and buckets of words. But very refined, very refined. Where was he the chief of police at first, Gus?
Right here in Seattle. Oh, he was only a chief of
police.
Well,
not a chief, but a regular cop.
San Diego.
San Diego, okay, yeah. Yeah, there's probably a lot more blacks in San Diego than Seattle, so that's probably nigger knocker days. I'm sure that he, I mean, you have to be an idiot to think that he is ignorant of being a racist. I mean, you are a police officer, a white cop, wrote a book about what you did to black people, and now you could just sit back and do interviews and play dumb. And I'm sure they paid money, and black people probably believe, you know, this guy is really a good guy. And nothing could be further from the truth. And I just wish they would listen to this episode, because no one really gave him that pushback that he would normally get, because it was just one quick question. And just letting him go on and on and on and on, unabated, and just sounding so stupid with the argument. I mean, anyone, I was like a kindergartner that you get. It just has no logic whatsoever. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Thank you for pointing out how, pointing out his response to my question. Now, I obviously believe with the chapter, or rather the opening of his book, how he mentions Ramos, Lou, and Goforth, that he is obviously on this war on cops tagline. You know, the idea that he believes that rhetoric from fringe groups is what made Shannon Miles go out and kill Debbie Goforth. Now, to my knowledge, Shannon Miles has not made a statement for the crime he is accused of. It is all of these other people that are saying he did it because of anti-police rhetoric from Black Lives Matter and all this other stuff. I mean, if Shannon Miles has made a statement, I mean, last I heard he was declared incompetent for trial, but if he has made a statement for the crime he is accused of, please let me know, because I just haven't heard it. And two, another reason why I say he's on the War on Cops program the fact that he focused on cops responding to Beyonce, saying, oh, they may have gone too far, but they have the right to protest, and not even deal with the fact that I mentioned that there's no anger towards the white cop killers who have killed 20 cops. He just totally ignored that, which means he obviously doesn't have a problem with white cop killers either. You know, and when you ask him, is he going to do anything to remedy his mistake? I mean, he didn't give a long-winded answer then. He said no. You know, Mister, I'm trying to do everything I can, but are you going to fix your problems you made? No. So that's all I have to say.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
That's I felt like he was practicing racism when he really didn't answer my question. He said that he didn't know what reason that black people should have to trust police officers. And then he went into talking about faith. I just started laughing when he said that. But yeah, he was practicing racism then there too.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. I wanted to chime in. I think it was the first speaker who discussed that what he had said about not wanting to abolish the police system and start from scratch. And my interpretation of that is he does not want to abolish the system of white supremacy. Like the brother alluded to, he knows the history of the police department. He was very explicit about that in the program. And understanding that the handmaiden of white supremacy, especially in the origins of the police department in slave catching by paddy rollers, to understand that the entire system that we're dealing with today is the descendant of basically white supremacy in the form of terrorizing black people, and to not think that it should be abolished and start and just that was another question I wanted to ask. I thought we were only able to ask one question, but I was going to ask him if he thought that the policing system in the country as we know it should be completely abolished and rebuilt under a totally different name, totally different premise, and rebuilt with the idea of justice in mind, simply due to the fact that the roots of the police system is racism, white supremacy. And when he said that he did not believe that because he had this vision of the chaos that would ensue, it just made me think, you know, none of the societies whites encountered, Native Americans, Africans, anywhere else, had a jail system. It was Europeans who had societies that were so lawless that they had to create a jailing system. Then they went and terrorized non-white people, and those people became the subversive insurgents in the countries that they created based on white supremacy. And as a result, they're now further abusing them by putting these people in jail. So who are the ones that really need the police? We didn't need them until we encountered white people. So that whole discussion to me, exactly what the brother said, I totally agree he was practicing racism, white supremacy, because to me when he said that, he was saying he does not want white supremacy to end via the people activity of law. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. I attempted to bring the conversation to a global level. I agree with you when you mentioned about his sophistication. I also accept your VGQ that is a special sophistication of white racist personalities that come out of Seattle, Washington. I've never been there. It may be true. but within two or three words, he brought it right back down to the level that he wanted it to be. And I never used the word policing. According to counter-racist logic, there is no such person that exists to police. You have to be able to serve and protect in all nine areas of activity. I don't know anyone that has been accomplishing that, white or non-white. So I specifically was talking about law enforcement on a global level. And with all of these huge weapon-endowed, sophisticated, white supremacist-controlled military forces around the world who make their own rules of engagement. And correct me if I'm wrong, if anybody can tell me anything that's not true, what I'm saying, they create their own rules of engagement. In 1776, it was the way they did things, as opposed to 2016 is the way they did things on whether they were going to engage, how they were going to engage, with who identified as their enemy. They even incorporate a lot of non-white people to go along with them for various reasons in this endeavor. And he quickly put it right back down, but unfortunately you muted me. Right after I asked the question, but nevertheless, that's okay. But nevertheless, that was my understanding of him practicing racist white supremacy. Also, because logic tells me that white people do not have a place at all to be able to mention to non-white people on our rules of engagement. Now, mind you, now there's some things that Michael Johnson or Mr. Long did that I may not do, but VGQ on them as far as what they decided to do if everything is the way it was said it was, which I'm not even sure on that, because if white supremacists have anything to do with it, there's probably some untruth that lies with both incidents or any incident that's ever taken place. But I do know one thing, that white people don't even have a place at all to open up their mouths on how we engage in violence at any time. And even, once again, even because white supremacy, counter-racist activity should be individually motivated to the standpoint that even I don't have a place to tell Mr. Johnson or Mr. Long or any other non-white victim on how they are going to engage in any type of counter action, you know, at all. So that's just my thoughts on the program today. This is my first time I think I can remember to question the guest. He did have his only value, in my opinion, was the correct procedure that people should have when they're stopped by the police. That's about it, as far as I'm concerned. And the rest, you know, he's, you know, high up on the suspect list. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Hello, Mr. Gus, callers and listeners. This is Douglas. I had asked a question to the individual, and he didn't answer my question either, and I agree with the other callers. He didn't answer anybody's questions, but that's what people who classify as white do. And I did want to ask for a pardon, if you could forgive me for asking too many questions. I missed that. I missed that part. I didn't hear that part, so if you could forgive me. But what I did want to say is, he did a lot of lying And as a number of the callers were saying, he did a lot of lying, and a kindergartner, a child, should be able to pick up on this. But then I wanted to point out the power of language and the mathematics of language. Language is, if I'm using the words correctly, please excuse me. Language is compulsionary, and it is instructional. Which means if I tell you to do something, you have to actually fight it to not do it. So if I say something absolutely stupid or absolutely doesn't make any sense, you actually still have to follow that instruction. It's a compulsion. If you have to do it, and I can explain that some other time. But just think of Hitler. You know, Welsing had mentioned, Dr. Welsing had mentioned that Hitler said often, you know, tell a lie, tell it real big, and keep saying it. Or I think that was Dr. Welsing said it, but I know I've read that. Hitler said very often, tell a lie, tell it real big, and keep saying it. And then people are going to follow the lie. But basically, language is instructional. Think about the pastors that tell you, you know, touch your neighbor, do this, do that. And it's compulsionary. You almost have to do it. You almost have to stop yourself from doing whatever you have been told to do. I wanted to say that. And I'm kind of losing my train of thought as far as what else I was going to say. So I'll go ahead and leave my line. Thank you.
Right. Well, no apologies about the. Yes, ma'am. I just wanted no apologies about the questioning thing. It was I had not been looking at the switchboard at first when I was doing my questions. And so then when I got ready to go to get callers, it was a lot of, as you heard, it was a lot of people who dialed in with questions. So I was just trying to get one question from everybody to try to get to as many people as I could. But yeah, no apologies, sir. Yes, ma'am. Caller in Michigan, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, do you know if Mr. Stamper's grandchildren are non-white?
I do not. I do not recall if we discussed that on any of his previous visits about, you know, his the mother of his children, to make sure if that is a white person, non-white person, and then his grandchildren who they have married and what have you. So I am not sure.
Okay, I asked. I thought on a previous visit he mentioned something about one of his grandchildren being non-white, and I could be incorrect, but I thought, and I just thought it was interesting that that's how he started off his commentary. So I was just wondering if that was the case. I felt like he was definitely practicing racism. And I think as he is getting older, he is just, you know, working to, you know, refine his practice more and more. But I definitely, you know, the buckets and buckets of words were, it was apparent, and I will get my line. I thought it was an interesting conversation. I thought when he was on the program before, he gave a little more information. This time it seemed like he was just practicing racism. So I'll mute my line. Thanks.
I would concur. That does fit a pattern as well in terms of what I've seen. And that's one you can definitely observe if you listen to the Cow's archives. Whites who have been on repeatedly, if they are, I mean, a tad more honest in their commentary the first time, it will drop almost with each successive visit. They will be a little less honest each and every time. And that's a pattern I've observed even off the air with whites, where they are not accustomed to bumping into too many victims who are a little bit less confused. And so you can kind of catch them by surprise, where they might be a little bit more honest just because they're not accustomed to bumping into non-white people who have a better grasp of what racism, white supremacy is, how it works. But then after that, they will do a better job. It's basically, we'll just go back and refine, recalibrate, like, oh, got to be a little bit more careful around those niggers. I'll watch my responses and that sort of thing. But again, you can kind of check that in the archives against the whites who've been repeat guests on the program. One of the folks who dialed in, I think this went with Thomas's question, and I think some of you all have commented on it as well in terms of a retired firefighter, his commentary around demanding, necessitating that victims of white supremacy be nonviolent in their response. One of our investors, he wrote, and he felt that was one of the top 10 moments of a white guest practicing white supremacy directly, blatantly, knowingly on the program. His non-response to, can you name a time when whites who felt mistreated, abused, aggrieved, when they responded nonviolently, and he could not come up with a response. And this is someone he wrote in his book about 9/11 and George Bush's response. Like, I mean, even the stuff that's going on right now, like, I do not hear Rudy Giuliani and folks saying we're going to be nonviolent and how we deal with the war on cops. I do not hear that. I do not hear whites saying we're going to be nonviolent and how we deal with ISIS. They're attacking Western civilization. That's current live examples right now. I do not hear that. I hear lots and lots of whites saying, we are not going to tolerate this, and we are going to get them, and ISIS and the war on cops, law and order. I think that was one thing I think he was a little bit honest about in terms of that just being code for white supremacy, but that's not anything sterling. I think that's pretty, that's commented on rather regularly. So that's not that big a deal, in my opinion, just being honest about that being an aspect, a pretty blatant aspect of white supremacy code, to just talk law and order, knowing what that means. We're going to get tough on these niggers. Other folks, anybody that had a hand up that we have not heard from, anybody with a hand up that we have not heard from, have commentary they want to make sure they got in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, this is John, and I'm calling from Lacey, Washington, your side of town, Gus. Just tuned in. You know, I didn't really get to catch Norm Stamper. I thought it was workplace racism, first-time caller. And what I've noticed is when these whites, they go on tours and talk and everything, they make a lot of money. You know, it's very lucrative for them to go around town and talk about racism when, you know, they're part of the root problem and they're causing it with their actions. You know, Tim Wise is a great example of that. And I didn't really notice until I started listening to the program. You know, I'm kind of angry at myself for missing the bulk of the program in the beginning, but, you know, I understand it a lot more, and I understand a lot when I see it. You know, before I would be like, hey, that's a good white person, you know, and they're trying to help the cause and they're working to help black people and, you know, all non-white people. You know, I didn't even use those words before. It was just black or white or Chinese or Asian. It's non-white, you know, or non-white, non-black, or, you know, non-white, black. I've been using that a lot with my kids and everybody. But, you know, Norm Stapper, you know, he's really refined in the way he does things. You know, he'll come close, get close to you, you know, try to be a friend, you know, but you have to really watch his words. Words are important. You know, that's basically all I have to say. And I'm going to try to get in for workplace racism next one.
Tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, workplace racism. We will, same program time. I think the server issue has been corrected, so that should not be an issue, but that'll be tomorrow, workplace racism.
I got you. I'm on the road. You know, I'm driving a truck all around, so I'm going to try to catch as much of the program as I can.
Right on. Right on. Good to hear from you. First time caller. Right on. And in our good old state of Washington at that. How about that? Other folks, anybody that we had not heard from? Anybody else that we have not heard from who had commentary they wanted to make sure they got in?
If not, can I make a brief, my last brief comment on the violence subject?
We didn't miss anybody? Nobody that had a hand up who we have not heard from?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just wanted to know, have you guys heard of I think it's called Fix for Peace? Where there's three black young males, they're going to the police department taking pictures with white officers.
I had not.
I think
heard.
It's
that. Oh, go ahead. Sorry about
I'm
that.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I think it's in
Sickersville, New Jersey, Winslow Department or something like that?
Picks for Peace. No, I had not heard of it. It does not surprise me. I think they did a pretty awesome imaging job. If like towards the end of 2014, where they had like an enforcement officer, I think he found a black person who might have been houseless, and he bought him some shoes or, you know, a carton of potato chips or something, and they made sure to make it a big photo op. Like, oh, this is the greatest white person ever. And then they had a white person, I think it was a black female. She, I think it might have been that she got arrested or caught trying to shoplift groceries because she didn't have resources. And instead of arresting her, he like bought her a bunch of groceries and they made a big photo op. I think that was here in Washington State, no less. But they did a lot of those campaigns. I think they had like a black person that was giving hugs, and they had a police officer come and give them a hug. It's just lots and lots of images to make it seem like, oh, yes, you know, there are whites who are about trying to solve this problem, and they're coming to take photographs with the Negros, and, you know, this is great. We're moving in the correct direction. It does not surprise me that, you know, you would have more of that with making sure we get these images out with black people and white people holding hands or hugging as though that represents problem solving and, you know, working towards a permanent solution to the problem of white supremacy racism. But no, I had not heard of that. Picks for Peace.
All right. And also, there was a white officer who got shot 7 times, I believe, by another white male. The reason why I believe it was a white male is because they didn't say any Blue Lives Matter or none of those rallies. It just had to this happened in Pennsylvania. I forget the town. I'll get the information and email it to you. But they had all the townspeople come out in support of this guy. And I think I caught it on the news. I think recently he did something at like a Phillies game or some type of baseball game recently. But yeah, they said he was shot like 7 times.
Wow. So I said that sort of thing, it happens. White people shoot enforcement officers much more frequently than black people. That's my conclusion. If I'm in error, folks can set me straight. But I mean, if you do some digging, like it happens on a pretty regular basis. White people have way more firearms than black people, and they are not subjected to nearly the same scrutiny. So, I mean, they, you know, do their Breaking Bad, and I mean, they brag about that sort of thing, getting riled up and going out. They make movies and things where they go out and kill enforcement officials. That's The Godfather. That's Breaking Bad. And these are heroes. These are not folks that whites are like, oh my God, this is the worst person ever. We need to get a robot and blow up Walter White or Michael Corleone. These end up becoming cultural icons, and that's what they do. They go out and kill enforcement officials. So, it does not surprise me at all, and I'm not surprised either way that this happened and that this did not become a big news event and that they're not talking about this at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. I think many, many folks have stated that it is no real concern about blue lives. The concern is the maintenance of white supremacy. If we hit everyone, retired firefighter, you were going to comment, sir?
Yes. Also, I recall the guest in a slick, shrewd way give examples of what this violence that he does not recommend. He was saying things like shooting someone in the car, assassinating somebody. And mind you now, to show you the hypocrisy of it all with a white person, as I mentioned before, I'm talking about global law enforcement. And the uniform is their white skin. That's their uniform. All of that stuff with the blue and all that kind of stuff is just a charade to confuse non-white people, and it starts from the top down as far as law enforcement is concerned, and they have shot the deaf people in their staff cars, not paying attention or not anything, just sitting there and killing them. They've dropped atomic bombs on people and killed women and children, babies. people who are not even affiliated with the opposing force, military-wise, at all. Apparently because their skin was, quote-unquote, according to them, yellow. And they have even, in disputes, just like gangsters do, in disputes with themselves, have done the same thing to each other. So as I mentioned before, it's just a huge amount of hypocrisy. And I have had conversations with white people when I was on that job and who have been in active combat. And so I know there are no rules. There are no rules that they are not willing to act upon when it's to their advantage of maintaining the global system of racist white supremacy, especially and after 1945, just about every conflict that I can recall that they've been engaged with has been with non-white people on a direct basis. And thank you for letting me have that piece.
For sure.
Extreme. Hey, guys, can I get in something briefly?
Yes, sir.
All right. Did I cut you off? I'm sorry.
No, sir.
Okay. I just wanted to chime in on the question that I had asked him when I had asked him about police wearing cameras being utilized to refine white supremacy. In regards to the constant showing of black death. And I found his answer to even to that question to be kind of amusing, because when you really look at exactly what we're seeing every day and just the recent events, period, how, you know, the shooting of all of these officers has now superseded the deaths of these black males in a way that's unprecedented. And now that we have this election coming up, both the RNC and the DNC are both trying to, you know, usher in that police support by playing up these incidents as well. And I thought when he made the statement that, you know, hopefully police don't see things that way because we're all human beings, I'm like, give me a break. Like, how many of us have to be killed? How many times do they have to show it on the news? How many different articles have to be put out on the same thing? And it's just on repeat. And then they're making movies about it as well. So that whole concept of police really caring about the lives that they take is nonsense, because the truth is when they kill us, they treat us like wild game safari animals. That's exactly what they treat us like. You know, no medical attention. They just leave you to bleed in the gutter like an animal. And I just found that to be very facetious and actually disrespectful. As a black male who has had a number of run-ins with the police, thank God I never ended up in greater confinement. But, I mean, some serious situations with police, it's like, for you to even tell me that is laughable. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
On cue. Race soldiers in action.
Okay.
The folks that tuned in, I know this has come up before, and we've talked about, you know, the rhetoric around criminal justice reform, as they call it, and ending the war on drugs and the racial disparities, as they call it, in drug sentencing and enforcement. His stance, since he said he wasn't just about cannabis legalization, he was about legalizing all drugs, and that will end the war on drugs, and that will have a major impact with regards to racism, white supremacy, and moving in the correct direction to solving the problem. Given the people that heard his stance on that have an impact on how people are processing legalizing drugs, and whites that say that this is gonna help us move in the correct direction of getting rid of racism if we legalize cannabis and or legalize all drugs.
That's a dangerous white male, because basically he wants to further a atmosphere to would make it would end up making it easier for non-white people to harm and or mistreat. I mean, white people to harm and or mistreat non-white people. And he knows that because he worked in that capacity for over 30 years.
I'll take it a step further and even say that
for them to legalize all drugs, I think to have a prominent former police chief and officer like him speak out like that might facilitate this taking place. But to take it even a step further, Thomas in New York discussed with me, and I think you too, and another caller, in regards to the destruction of the war on drugs, basically facilitating the war on urban domestic terrorism, which the face of which is black due to these incidences with these alleged black males that allegedly killed these officers. So I just think him even talking about pushing for the legalization of all drugs is really refining the system of racism and white supremacy, because then they can move forward with black males being the number one urban domestic terrorists that are on this proverbial war with police. So that's what I really think. I took it a step further just in his psychological perception, because that gives them even more carte blanche to be more violent with us, simply because we're already the face of everything that they're supposedly scared of in the first place. And I don't understand what they're scared of. You know, they're the ones walking around with the guns. They're the ones who the brutality has always been one-sided. So there's never been a situation in which black people just went out and wholesale kill police officers or wholesale kill white people. So where's the fear coming from, unless it's the fear of black people doing to them what they've done to us, which goes back to what the firefighter in Florida said earlier, which I completely concur with. Thank you.
Any other folks?
Well, I personally don't think white people are afraid of black people. I would contest that argument. In fact, I don't think white cops are afraid of black males at all. That's what their whole purpose of becoming a cop is, to go and be able to go mistreat some black people. And even when you look at these incidents that make the news, you know, Daniel Pantaleo, he didn't look scared, jumped right on my man's back. My man was 3 times his size. Put him in a chokehold, no problem. I mean, doesn't seem like the guy who shot Tamir Rice, I mean, that was just an assassination. No fear at all. Jumped right out, shot. I mean, I don't see, you know, when I see the cops that are not white, I think that Asian cop was really scared in that hallway, going up there with his gun out. I think that even when you look at the guy in Minnesota, you know, that cop was obviously rattled. You heard how he was screaming at the lady. That cop was not white as well, so they say. So you see the level of fear or anguish in their voice. I don't see that from these white cops. It's like, hey, you know, you're going to have a party later. You know, you're going to get treats. You know, you got one. You know, meet up at the bars. You know, get a couple of hookers. You know, that's how they do. I mean, this is part of what they became a cop for. And I don't agree with that notion at all.
I did want to ask the drug response, because I do think that is important in terms of them saying this push to legalize cannabis and or legalize all drugs. Any thoughts, given his commentary, his performance, if you will, this evening? Any thoughts on his stance about legalizing all drugs, that that's going to somehow benefit moving us towards solving the problem of white supremacy racism?
I think the only reason why they want to legalize all drugs now is because the more people that are coming up on these more stage one narcotics are white. It's not as much as prevalent in the black community as it once was. I mean, when I grew up, it was crazy. But right now, I don't see 50 crackheads. I don't see people leaning on the street corners like I used to. It's not like that. But when I go downtown, who's asking for change? Who's leaning over? Who's just sitting there with a sign feeding me, and they're knotted up on dope? It's all white people. Yeah, they want to legalize it now that it's them. I think that's a consistent pattern I'm noticing from all white people. In fact, here in New York, they had ended the state council, just to put a convention. So they ended it a little early this year. And they said that they couldn't come to an agreement on anything, but one thing was this legislation for heroin victims, they called them, heroin victims. So, you know, it's totally different rhetoric now that there's white people on it. And that's why I think that his whole lingo is, let's legalize, because his kids is the ones doing it.
Yep. And can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Out here in Washington, I noticed, too, there's treatment centers popping up everywhere. You know, they're hooked on drugs more now. You know, I grew up in Brooklyn myself, you know, but I was in the military and I moved out here. But I noticed treatment centers, you know, almost everywhere. Matter of fact, there's one right around the corner from my house, and they're putting an expansion on it. You know, they're building it to a couple of acres big, the building itself. You know, when I first saw it, when I first moved here, it was two buildings and a little parking lot. Now it's basically like a shopping mall, you know, and there are people around here, it's like a mask over the city, you know, they have it all clean and nice, but, you know, you turn a corner, there's drug addicts everywhere, and most of them are non-black, white people. And that's, growing up in New York, I used to walk, I used to see crack vials on the ground almost everywhere, you know. I picked one up and I gave it to a police officer. He told me, just put that garbage back on the street, that's it. That's all I got to say.
He does talk about the massive problem of heroin addiction out here in Seattle and gives praise to the needle exchange program and how they're dealing with all that. He just doesn't point out that that is whites. And I mean, like, way heavily white, like over 85% white that are having this problem out here in the Seattle area, probably Washington State on the whole, but certainly Seattle. I mean, that is like almost an exclusive white thing. And that was one of the questions I was even going to ask. The reason that they have this leading the nation in terms of looking at this not as a criminal thing, but as a healthcare problem. And let's get these people help, even employing the word victim, which, I mean, they jump up and down like, you're not a victim of racism. What are you talking about? That's not empowering, blah, blah, blah. But white people, oh, these poor victims of heroin. I mean, even the words. But he points that out. He just doesn't include race in the analysis of the problem and why they're dealing with it in this manner. It's because it's whites, not black people, where it's just been, hey, get your nigger knocker and go to town. Let's, you know, give them a decade in prison, 2 decades in prison.
And I'm, you know, right around the corner from the Capitol. You know, excuse me for cutting you off there, but I can see the Capitol from, you know, just walking down the street. I could look at the Capitol building, and you go down to the Capitol in Olympia, it's even worse down there.
Wow.
They have a whole bunch of streets downtown Olympia where, you know, there's homeless people in the corner, and none of them are non-white. None of them are black, non-white.
And I was I was going to say, I thought that in and of itself, the fact that they're not giving the race, like now you don't hear about the race of the drug addicts. Whereas, you know, like Thomas was saying, when we were growing up, it was, you know, niggas are acting crazy. They're all high, and you're going to rape your white daughters. And I mean, it was crazy. So, I mean, I think just the whole concept of not putting the race of these people as being white drug addicts now being the face of drug addiction, not that they weren't the face of drug addiction before, but now it's on a much more public stage than it's ever been, because I think heroin takes you to such a low that you just cease to care about anything, and you just, you know, you just don't care. You just do whatever comes natural to a drug addicted person. So I think that's a high level of refinement. And there was something Thomas said earlier that I wanted to chime in on, when he said that he doesn't believe that white police or white people are scared of black people. I can definitely agree with that. I don't think they're physically scared of us, but I think that's the genius of Dr. Welton's perception when she speaks of genetic annihilation. It creates this sort of knee-jerk response to the way that they treat black people. And one thing I wanted to also say that he made me think about is, I think the so-called fear that white police officers claim to feel when they shoot black people for, you know, showing them their wallet or whatever the case may be, versus the fear, quote unquote, that non-white officers feel is different. I think the white officers' fear is a fear of genetic annihilation, and they have the means via their job to practice white supremacy and psychopathology and get away with it behind the law. The non-white people, I think, have been cultivated psychosocially to believe that black people are predatory. So in other words, the ideas that white people propagate about black men being more dangerous is the idea that, or the fear that I believe is exhibited by non-white police officers when they kill black males. And the fear that white officers exhibit when they kill black males is a fear of genetic annihilation that they mask behind this black people are the face of crime, and every time you look at the news, there's a black man in cuffs for doing something. So that's what I think. I could be wrong, but I just believe that the fear of non-white officers that kill black people is more about what society says, that black men are predators versus white people who are afraid of being genetically annihilated. Thank you.
Right on. We pretty much did our 3 hours. We'll be here tomorrow. The only thing I was going to add, the black officers, what Raj just said, totally logical, makes total sense, counter-racist logic. My suspicion, a good number of the black enforcement officials, when they're going out and participating in abusing and mistreating black people, I suspect on some level they are probably afraid of the white coworkers that they are with, that if they do not go out and brutalize these black people, that they too might get it from their white colleagues. And Mr. Stamper even wrote about that in Breaking Rank, as have many other black officers. We even had a former Chicago police officer on the program where she talked about the same thing, going into meetings with some of these white brutes in Chicago and having to unholster her gun because she didn't know what was going to go down. I strongly suspect that on a conscious or subconscious level, it could be, if I don't go out here and nigger knock some of these black people, they are going to get me. Oh, and that'll be a great place where I can conclude. I think Roz mentioned Black Mask, the movie, this past Saturday, and I just forgot because other people were on, blah, blah, blah. I have not seen the movie Black Mask. I started to watch it. I saw like 30 minutes, and I just got distracted and didn't get to pick back up. However, someone mentioned it when it was in the theaters a while ago, saying that they wanted to watch it for counter-racist purposes. And I suggest, as I consistently do, reading is more important than watching television. Reading and writing more important than watching television. Now, that movie is based on a book. The book by the same name, Black Mask. One of the co-authors of that book, Dick Lehr, has been on this program before. The portion of the movie that I saw did not have as much racism as the book has. The book, the movie and the book are based on Whitey Bulger, white gangster up in Boston, did all this criminal activity, glorified, did all this criminal activity and what have you. They just had his trial, I think like last year. It's really recent. Anyway. The book has a lot more racism than the movie. The book, basically, the backdrop of this is the racism that was going on in the city of Boston, and them being upset about the busing crisis. Now, again, I didn't get to see the whole film, so maybe more of it is there, but I doubt it, because it is big time a feature in the book that this is kind of the backdrop of how this is going on, and the main characters, Whitey Bulger and people, they're commenting about this. They're upset because the niggers want to go to school with their children and blah, blah, blah. Like, it was, I did not expect that racism was going to be this explicitly featured in the book by the same title. I got the book the same time that the film was mentioned to me. I was not expecting that. And so I was like, wow, people should probably get this book. Now, it is a longer book, so I doubt we would ever do it on the book club or what have you, but it might be worth checking out the book. I would say that in addendum because Dick Lehr, he was a guest on the program. We talked about a different book that he wrote called The Fence, which is in Boston, which connects with the previous point that I made, the whole program for today. Great spot to end on. And again, reading is more important than watching television. The Fence is about in Boston. These officers, white and black, they were chasing a suspect. Black officer was there. It was nighttime. They were going down an alley or what have you, chasing the suspect. The black cop gets separated from the white cops. So he's chasing the suspect. They're all chasing this guy. The white officers come. They see the black officer. They just, oh, man, nigger. And they beat him down. They beat him unconscious. He's bleeding, all this. And then after they've almost killed him, they realize, like, oh, man, this is not the suspect. This is our partner. And you can even add allegedly, because this might have just been, you know, we're just in the mood to beat down a nigger. And, you know, oh, well, it happens to be our fellow officer. He's black. So, you know, you'll have to do for the evening. Anyway, they beat him down, almost kill him, and leave him at the fence. So he goes to the hospital and, you know, all this. And they're trying to figure out what happened. How did they make this mistake? You know, what? Just get to the bottom. What happened?
the black officer, he is not going to call Al Sharpton. He is not calling in Jesse Jackson. He's not going to get Alton Maddox as his attorney. This happened a while ago. He's not going to do all of this. He's, you know, not trying to play the racism angle at all. He's not giving press conferences and wigging out or anything. All these, hey, I just, you know, want to get my health back together. And I want to get to the, you know, let's find out what happened. Make sure that this never happens again. Let's have an honest investigation and, you know, move forward as, you know, brothers in law enforcement. They harass him. They are hanging out at his house. They're like vandalizing his vehicle. All of that. He's not doing anything. Just, you know, let me get my health back. Let's find out what happens so this doesn't happen again and get back on the job. And they just harass and terrorize him and his family. I mean, it is disgraceful beyond words. But he wrote a book about this called The Fence. And that was when he was on the program in December of 2009, which I would definitely, you know, check that out. Keep that in context when people talk about black enforcement officials. But I would say that just number one, the Black Mask, written by the same author, co-authored by the same author, Dick Lehr. It has a lot of racism in it. If you want to check that out, backgrounding the story of Whitey Bulger and what I said before about black enforcement officials, my suspicion, consciously, subconsciously, I think they might be afraid of their fellow armed white co-workers. That will do it for today. We'll be here tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, workplace racism. Certainly the events in Baton Rouge, Dallas, the Republican National Convention, I suspect that has creeped into the workplace atmosphere. I have heard news reports that have substantiated that. So if folks have commentary on how that has impacted your days on the job, your time on the job this week, feel free to share tomorrow. We will be here. We'll be here Friday for the book club, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, and Saturday, compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. If you get confused, have questions, gripes, guest suggestions, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. If we did not get a chance to get your question to Mr. Stamper, my apologies, but I think we got the vast majority of folks who dialed in. With that, I will again encourage sobriety would be best, and particularly under these conditions, I do think that you will have a ramped up number of armed whites with a badge who feel like vengeance is mine, and they will be looking to take it out on any black person, male, female, child, whatever the case may be. Keep that in mind. I think sobriety would be best in terms of dealing with those encounters so that you can make the best possible decision to keep yourself as safe as possible. You and anyone that you might be responsible for. If you're going to be in a vehicle, buckle up every time. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. And certainly you do not want to be intoxicated. That is driver, passenger, even as a pedestrian. You do not want to be out and about intoxicated. That just makes the job of Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw, Daniel Pantaleo, any of these other race soldiers way easier to do whatever they want, terrorizing you, even taking your life. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. That's it. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, no brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.